Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
Paying too much for cable? Get Dish Network and get a special offer just for WRIF listeners. Two DVRs and an iPod. Call 866-897-4244. 866-897-4244. Or click for details.
The Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, let me get this out of the way. There you go. Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Joining me in the studio, Jalene Jordan, our producer and on-air host with me.
Hi,
how
dear.
You doing?
Oh, doing great.
We're all excited, but we got to do some business first. Welcome to the broadcast. Night Call again, brought to you this hour by Waking Up, Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store. It's located out in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder and Warren. You can go to wakingupstore.com. For the month of February, Mike Kitchen, who is the proprietor, writes that all books and magazines are 10% off. And in honor of African American History Month, for the purchase of $50 or more, you'll get a free soft cover copy of Down Through the Years, written by former Detroit City Council President Irma Henderson and Waking Up owner Mike Kitchen. So Mike wrote this.
That's a nice deal.
And he also writes, could you say hi from us to the man from Sweden who with his family made a special trip to our store just before Christmas? Mike says that the guy from Sweden listens to us by downloading the show from whiterosesociety.org. And Mike says anyone who travels all the way from Sweden to stop at our store definitely deserves a special hello.
Oh, I should say so.
Now, we're the character of this show is not altered. So when we start saying we're just going to talk about the Grammys.
Don't worry. It's not that chick who's on the air with you now.
It's about
influencing
it's
a, you.
It's about some chicks from Dixie.
That's right.
In fact, Jalene Jordan, I'm excited about this, but you're about four times more excited.
I am very excited about
this. Go for it.
The Grammys, well, in general, this is what I'm excited about, and I know it will be good news to you, that there were no fewer than 12 nominees putting an anti-war message to music.
Wow.
Tonight at the Grammys, and that includes the Dixie Chicks. You love them or you hate them, I know it, but I happen to personally think they stand for some pretty damn good things.
I love them.
Yes, and so far I know that they have won Best Country Duo or Group. They won, which is funny because the country music industry completely shunned them, and this is kind of a rock record, really.
Sure.
They won Best Song for Not Ready to Make Nice, their song to old GW.
Yeah, but also, remember Natalie Maines, the lead singer, she was appearing right after that flap occurred where they said they were ashamed that Bush was from Texas. And culturally, they were part of the unraveling of Bush Co. They were some
right.
of the first to, wait, let me see, I think my voice will sound better there. There you go. Who began saying the emperor has no clothes. So
yeah.
we owe a real debt of thanks because think about some of you. I'm sorry. I don't mean to say I told you so and all that, but I did tell you so. And Jillian Jordan told you so. And a lot of other people told you so, that this was a load of crap that Bush and the rest of them were peddling to us. The Dixie Chicks knew it. And they got a lot of, you know, they didn't, let me tell you this. The Dixie Chicks, they were pulled from all these country stations because, in some cases, hundreds of listeners called into these stations. Turned out that they were all Rush Limbaugh listeners and not even country fans, because when they would, they were one of the top, the year that they got pulled off, what was it, 03? Was it, I think?
I think it was right around, yeah. I think it was exactly 03, yeah.
They were the top grossing touring act for concerts.
Wow, so people, I did not know that.
All the concerts were sold out. And Natalie Maines always appeared, and on her shorts would write F-U-T-K. I'm not going to tell you what the F-U
stands. Oh, wait, I remember this now.
Yeah, T-K.
It's all coming back to me.
Yeah, F-U, I'm not going to say that, but T-K was Toby Keith, one of these real patriotic country guys, you know?
He is very patriotic.
Yeah, screw him.
In that, you know, obnoxious sense.
Yeah, in the very obnoxious sense.
Right. So, Joan Baez.
Oh, man.
She was on the show, and she announced the Dixie Chicks when they performed Not Ready to Make Nice Tonight. Joan Baez, who talked about, you know, their bravery and their inclusion in a long history of protests, you know,
singers
and singer-songwriters, yeah. Exactly. She brought up Woody Guthrie.
Amazing. Yeah.
Which is really cool. Anyway, there were a lot of other bands. So, you know, good news for the Dixie Chicks. They've come kind of full circle. Neil Young is nominated for Rock Album, Rock Song, Solo Rock Performance. I don't really know how any of these turned out because I was getting ready for the show. I had to leave. Bob Dylan, The Flaming Lips, one of those bands that was nominated. They their issue was criticism of Bush's ability to lead and America as the world's policeman. One of their key lyrics in the Flaming Lips song we're talking about, you haven't got a clue, you used your money and your friends to try and trick me.
Do you think that they were that... I wonder if this has been on television before. Hey, here's Neil Young. I love this.
Yeah, the key lyrics right here.
I love this.
The White House shadows who hide behind closed doors. They bend the facts to fit with their new story. Or why we have to send our men to war.
Let's get the chorus in here. That's Neil Young from his album Living with War. And is that one of the ones that's up for?
Looking for a leader, solo rock performance. And I think that is it, actually, isn't
really?
It?
Really? I don't even like that song.
You don't?
I'm not looking for a leader.
Yeah, I know you're not.
I'm looking to get rid of leaders.
Well, yeah. Yeah. Well, Neil's not quite as...
Rad. Let's say it. Let's get right down with it.
Let's just say it.
Yeah. I like After the Garden, Living with War. And Let's Impeach the President. They talk about a song being anthemic, right? Like an anthem.
Oh, sure.
This one really, really does. It still there? Yeah, there it is.
There he is.
Neil Young.
Neil, way to go.
Neil Young, still with a big fuzz tone.
And you know that this album had critical success. Did you know that? Number 15 on the Billboard 200 album chart now.
Mm-hmm.
Recorded it in 9 days. 9 days, yeah.
Well, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash, Crosby, Stills, and Nash were touring there, joined by Neil Young. And at each of the concerts last summer, they would play this Let's Impeach the President, and it would be the words would be projected up on the screen, and the whole audience
would sing it?
Would stand up and sing it.
Oh, gee. Yeah. That's awesome. I would have liked to have been in that audience.
Yeah. Yeah. So
anyhow, a lot of these bands, Bruce Springsteen and Slayer, we have to say that because Al...
Yeah.
He's answering the phones, by the way, when you talk to him.
Do we love Al? And you guys got a WRIF listeners, after all the talk is done at 2 a.m., got a special treat.
Yeah, Al is going to
rock and roll.
Rock and roll up
That's
until
right.
5 a.m.
Yeah.
So tune in to him. Anyways, Slayer was also nominated. And remember the band Ministry? You know, real,
sure.
Okay.
An
they,
80s, they 80s
did,
band?
An entire CD themselves. Like with the song Lies, 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 and I didn't even know about that
yeah.
one. So.
Well, if you, all you'd have to do is say rock and roll, and go to Google, put like rock and Bush, or rock anti-Bush, and you could probably spend the rest of your life downloading songs.
Yes.
Maybe, I don't know, sometimes I think maybe we don't have to do the show. We just play music. I was just listening more. I mean, we talk about David Rovix, like he's the only singer around. But
he does a lot.
Yeah, he does an amazing.
Recognition.
And also, I'm thinking of the old Monty Python routine when they're pretending they're Australians, right? And they said, culture. Culture, we got culture up to our a-holes, you know. So on another cultural level, I took a tour, something I haven't done maybe since I was in my teens, to the famous Greenfield Village that was established by Henry Ford, you know, the great Hitler lover, but he at least has, they're talking about biting the hand that feeds you. The publicists invite me out there. My wife and I went out.
Oh, Peter. I can't wait to hear this.
Oh, I was blown away by the Henry Ford Museum and Greenfield. Yeah. Well, Greenfield Village is outside, so it's too cold. But we went out there because there is this famous chair. Now, this sounds kind of boring. Actually, it is. But there's this famous chair called the Eames Chair. It's the 50th anniversary of it. It's done with, some of the chairs you'd seen. You go, yeah, well, I've seen a million of those in every auditorium in the country. But these are ones that were pretty innovative half a century ago.
Okay.
And my dad has one of these leather chairs. Actually, the chair is in...
He's an architect,
in,
right? Some sort of designer?
Designer.
Yeah.
In Fraser, they have this leather chair that's his favorite chair. Did you ever see
that? Yes, beat up and duct tape and all that.
Well, that is the Eames chair. So it turned out, I really associate this with my father, and I really... So I was very interested to see it. Yeah, it was kind of boring. It was just a chair.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just a chair.
So what you're saying is it wasn't the chair from Fraser. That is the type of chair they had in Fraser.
That's the type of chair.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Okay. But what we did see, among jillions of other things, was their civil rights display in which they had the very actual authentic bus on which Rosa Parks refused to get up.
That's right. I remember when it arrived in Detroit.
And they got this. It was totally trashed.
Yes.
They found it. They knew because it had the number. And they spent some incredible amount, like $200,000. They sent it back to the plant that made it out in Pontiac, Michigan. I think maybe GM Coach or something like that. Completely restored it. So you get on this bus, and it's like the day that it rolled off of the assembly line in 1948, I think it was May. And so all this happened in, she got arrested in December of 1955, and then the big boycott in Montgomery, Alabama, the bus boycott led by Martin Luther King, who was all of 26 years old.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And we got on the bus, the two, you know, my wife, and I wish I could say her name, but she won't let me.
No,
yeah,
you can't break the rule,
yeah,
Peter.
Yeah, so my wife and I, we get on the bus, and there's a docent, in other words, someone who, yeah. That knows this stuff and tells you about it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like a tour guide?
Tour guide, except in museums. They call them docents.
Okay,
you know,
well, that's
they,
good to know.
That's why culture.
How do you spell that?
I don't know.
Okay.
Culture. We got culture up to our a-holes here. So we get on the bus, and then it's kind of hushed, and they have the lights of the bus are the actual, lighting the bus is the actual lights of the bus of the ceiling, and the docent says, do you want to hear a recording of Rosa Parks explaining why she got arrested, and this is from January of 1956. So we said, sure. And she said, And also, they told us, you could sit in the seat where she actually refused to get up and started the civil rights revolution. So I said, sure. And then I went over there, and all of a sudden I thought, I'm this white man sitting in Rosa Parks' seat.
You just didn't feel right about it?
I sat there for about 3 seconds. I couldn't even, and, you know, I don't deal in guilt. That's not why I'm motivated. Okay. It wasn't even that. It just, it was
overwhelming.
It was very overwhelming experience.
I bet it was.
But everything, if you don't buy that, hey, you can go see a chair. A train.
Oh.
They have like a, you know, like a 10-car train in the place. They have Buckminster Fuller's actual 1,100-square-foot round aluminum house.
It really is interesting out there.
It is. You've been there.
I have been there. It's been a few years, but and I have not seen the Rosa Parks bus. But I have people coming into town in a couple weeks. I think I'll take them out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me know. I'll go with you.
Okay.
And if never mind.
All right.
All right. Here's our phone number. Oh, yeah, that's right. We get callers on the air. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And if you want to email us, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes. Now,
There's a lot going on.
How about this? Reverend Ted is completely heterosexual.
I don't even know where to go with this thing.
Well,
he's completely heterosexual after 3 weeks.
3 weeks, yeah. He was getting banged by this gay prostitute while he was snorting crystal meth, right?
Right.
So now he's completely...
For 3 years, mind you. For 3 freaking years.
Whoa, he scared me there.
Oh, no. I read this. I didn't know it was for 3 years.
Yeah.
I thought maybe it was a couple little... dalliances or whatever you say. Now, here's what he said. Did you like this one? After 3 weeks of counseling in Phoenix, he felt like it was 3 years worth of analysis and treatment.
Yeah. Here, Dr. Jack Dresser, a New York psychiatrist. Now let me set the stage, by the way, who Reverend Ted Haggard is, if you don't remember that. He is the man who was head of this evangelical association. And also, he was promoting a constitutional amendment in Colorado to bar same-sex marriage. So the prostitute, this guy named Michael Jones, he was so put off when he found out who he was that he was this incredible hypocrite. He was the head of the National Association of Evangelicals, and he plays and you can tell what a kind of mean, nasty man he is if you've ever seen the documentary Jesus Camp, which is up for an Academy Award. You haven't seen that.
I haven't seen that, but I did see the Alexandra Pelosi documentary, and he is in that. That's scary.
Talking about sex. Guy's got sex on the brain.
Obviously.
Yeah, right.
Which, there's nothing wrong with that.
He says, now, Reverend Ralph, who's this guy here, somewhere around here, Reverend Ralph told the Denver Post that Mr. Haggard had come out of the counseling. Oh, okay. I thought he was going to say come out of the closet.
Oh.
Counseling, convinced of his heterosexuality. Reverend Ralph told the Post he's completely heterosexual. All right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, this headline, I gasped.
Yeah. Now, hey, we are a gay-friendly program.
That's right.
Right? And
sure.
Absolutely. And we say to people that are homophobic, get over it, right?
Yes.
So the only thing that we object to, if I can say we, I think you agree, is like the prostitute that narked on Reverend Haggard, that we hate hypocrites.
Oh, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of that running around out there.
Do you think?
Including, did you see the final little bit there, Peter? Mr. Haggard said in his message to New Life members, that was his church of how many thousands of people at this big church, that he and his wife were taking online courses to get master's degree in psychology. Okay?
I didn't see the online.
Online master's degrees in psychology.
Well, a New York psychiatrist, Dr. Jack Dresser, who's an expert on issues of gender and sexuality, said that while it was people's prerogative to identify their sexual orientation as they wanted, the notion of being able to change that orientation was, quote, not consistent with clinical presentations, but totally consistent with theological belief. In other words, he was trying to nicely say, Reverend Ted, you're lying.
Yeah, Reverend Ted, you've got some urges that really aren't going to go away.
Well, I mean, I'm sure there are enough people, I mean, the old phrase, in the closet, there are people that have function through their whole life, denying their sexual orientation, and that's their business.
Yes.
Yeah. If people want to, for whatever reason, I mean, it doesn't make sense. I mean, sexual, not oppression.
Repression?
Repression. Thank you. Thank you. Sexual repression does not do well for your emotions. But, hopefully there's an atmosphere that's more open today. And in fact, let me see, I don't know when we're going to do this, at 1 or 1:30, we're going to be interviewing Jeff Montgomery, who's the chair of Detroit's Triangle Foundation, the premier group for, I can't remember always to say the whole thing, gays, lesbians, bisexuals,
transgender,
and allied community.
Oh, didn't know that last part.
We're allied community, right?
Yes. Don't look at me that way. You'd like to do that.
I do.
Anyway, old Reverend Ted, good luck to you, right?
None of my business.
You and your wife and your five kids.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Your congregation that shunned you. But I'm sure he'll be right back.
Well, it's nice to, or I shouldn't say it's nice. It's never nice. Remember, it's nice to be important, but it's even more important to be nice, which I frequently am not.
But you know what?
These people do real harm to folks.
They do. Yeah. And I wish that his congregation would have, instead of kicked him out, done the Christian thing and embraced him and said, we love you no matter what you do. We love you for admitting your sins or whatever they're going to say.
Whatever.
Okay, sorry.
All right. Now, here's how religion often functions. And I said before, whenever, I get into my anti-religious or my atheist thing, that I would say that empirically, that is, when I look out at the world and who I interact with, if someone said to me, what do you think about the religious people you know, which include Christians, Muslims, and Jews, and a few mixed other people, I would say they're all wonderful people, particularly the pagans. But even the people that often I'm critical of in the formal authoritarian hierarchical religions that are the most prominent in this country and the world, I would still say that I know them as good, kind people that are striving for peace and social justice. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't have any hard line on religion like I do. But unfortunately, the people that I know, and I'm sorry, I know some of you are listening and you probably either find this offensive or sad or maybe even unfortunate that I'm bringing it up, but they're not the majority. So that's it. I'll go on. Actually, we didn't get to this last week. A woman who told the Tampa police that she'd been raped. Now, you ready for this? This woman goes into a Tampa police station. She tells them she was just raped, and they jailed her for 2 days after officers found a warrant accusing her of failing to pay restitution for a 2003 theft arrest. So that's what they do to her. I mean, the trauma. Guys, we can only imagine, and probably not even imagine, what it must be like to be sexually assaulted. The kind of trauma, emotional trauma, the kind of just fear and I don't know what, anger, disgust, everything under the sun. While a woman was behind bars, now she's raped, right? A jail worker refused to give her a second dose of the emergency contraceptive pill because of religious convictions.
I just don't know what to say about this other than I'm just completely disgusted by this story.
It is. Her lawyer said she's a victim of the system, do you think? There's just got to be some humanity involved when it's a victim of rape. The police department said it was changing its policy to give officers more discretion. It seems like they should have less discretion. It's like these pharmacists that won't fill prescriptions for, like, contraceptives, even.
Yeah.
And, you know,
let alone the 24-hour overnight pill.
Yeah. There's a... there's a bill, or I think a law, in Illinois that demands that pharmacists fill prescriptions. I mean, what the hell is that? I mean, that a druggist can say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you the birth control pill.
It's really out of control at that point.
It is. I actually have about 9 more anti-religious stories, but...
Is that because atheism is hot?
It is hot. I can't believe it.
It really is. We're not joking.
You know, Bush himself, actually, not the whole mob. If you think about it, Cheney and Rumsfeld, they never did much with Christianity. But Bush and all these right-wing Christians around him, they have sunk Christianity. I don't think for good or in, but...
I don't think they've sunk it low. I'm talking about Jerry Falwell.
Right.
And when you see this Alexandra Pelosi documentary that you can catch on HBO from time to time. I can't remember the name right now, but Time for God or something like that.
Yeah.
How they organize and get their congregations together and show them these films that have big, bold words saying, vote your conscience, vote with what is more in line with who you are as a human being and as a religious human being. It's scary.
Well, you've got to see Jesus Camp.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. And that is in, it's available for rental now.
Well, I interviewed the co-director, Heidi, can't remember her last name. She's from Farmington Hills. And I said, didn't you hate these people? And she said, no. She seemed kind of shocked. And she said, why did you dislike them? I said, because they kept making these children cry. They kept reducing these children to tears with all their, you know, their stuff about abortion and fear of hell and what have you. Here's what I think. There, a lot of people have heard This American Life, this version of this this protege of Oral Roberts, right-wing Christian hustler, you know, for dollars guy.
Large university or several or something like that.
So, and then there's his son, Nasal Roberts.
What?
And
oh, stop it.
No, I forgot. Oh, yeah. So this preacher's got this mega church, just like Reverend Ted Haggard, except this protege isn't doing crystal meth and guys. Yeah.
Okay.
So at one point, he's reading the Bible, and he comes to this conclusion. Christ died for our sins. Okay? But it doesn't...
What? He came to that all by himself?
Well,
didn't he hear that somewhere?
Well, but bigger emphasis. Because it doesn't say anywhere, like the evangelicals do, that you have to accept Jesus Christ as your personal Savior. It says Jesus died for your sins. So this reverend interpreted it as, he did, our sins are washed away, everybody goes to heaven. All the sinners, all the serial killers, all the abortionists, all the atheists. Yeah. Everybody gets to sit at God's knee, you know. All right, you just killed 19 people. Say hello to the old man, you know.
Well, it's kind of like the whole Hail Mary thing, right? You say a few and things are better.
Yeah. Well, on the other hand, I was talking to a religious, an Orthodox Jew in this shoe store, and he says, you know, Jews don't believe in hell. I said, really? And maybe it's in line with this guy. He said, yeah. He said, I feel really sorry for the Christians. Couple mistakes, you're gone, you know. Like that.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean,
I tell you.
Yeah.
That's kind of funny.
We're having so much fun, although we're talking about serious stuff as well. If you want to join us, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Let me see. We've got about, let's do 3 minutes. Oh, all of a sudden people are calling. I don't remember whether I said this last week, but this is like rewards being offered. A right-wing American think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, is offering $10,000 to scientists and economists to dispute a climate change report that the UN released. Remember, they said that it was
climate change.
Yeah, that it's irreparable. Not that it's, you know, like 95% sure that it's from human activity.
Yes.
That it's going to affect us for centuries. So these right-wing neocons, which receives funding from, guess what? Oil giant ExxonMobil.
Ah, ding, ding.
That ripped us off. But that one of the reasons we have negative savings, as we talked about last week, they're offering this. So $10,000. Now, I'm not a scientist, and I'm not an economist, but I would go for $3,000.
You would go?
I would, let me see. I would dispute climate change.
Oh, okay.
$3,000. I mean, hey. They're offering, you know, these are whores.
What's your plan?
I'm going to contact. I don't know. I mean, these guys don't make any sense when they try to refute it. Why should I?
That's true.
But here, you can make more money. $25,000 from our friends at the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. And they're offering $25,000 reward for the coordinates in the... what do they call it? The Antarctic area, where they are chasing down Japanese whalers, illegal whalers.
They are something else, this organization. If you don't know about them, it's seashepherd.org.
Right. Chris Carter, the New Zealand Minister for the Environment, knows where the Japanese whaling fleet is illegally slaughtering whales but refuses to give up the coordinates. So Captain Paul Watson is offering a reward of $25,000 if they will tell him. Well, they then found out where they were, and the Japanese are all upset because one of the things that Sea Shepherd did, they took this little Zodiac. You know what those are? It's kind of like a big inflated rubber raft with a huge outboard motor. I was on a Greenpeace Zode, as they call them.
Were you really?
Going about 20, I don't know. It was fast, 20 miles an hour. I don't know if you've ever gone 20 miles an hour on water close to it. It's scary, I'll tell you. But anyway, one of the Sea Shepherd Zodes boarded this Japanese illegal whaler and poured, now where is this stuff?
It's a kind of acid.
Butyric, is that how you say it? We don't know. B-U-T-Y-R-I-C. And
right.
It says, so you're going, oh, man, they're pouring acid on these
yeah,
people.
Yeah, what are those people doing?
I think what it is a big stink bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that article, it says something about it being harmless to humans somehow.
Yeah.
And, you know, this organization isn't one to go and you know, purposely cause harm to people.
They've never harmed anyone.
That's right.
Although they've sunk something like six illegal whaling vessels.
And that's the thing. There is an international moratorium
on
whaling, but Japan tries to slip through the cracks by saying that they're whaling for scientific purposes.
When it winds up as sushi.
Exactly.
Which sushi, I mean, I'll tell you. I mean,
I
like sushi.
I think it's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know.
But you know what? I don't eat raw sushi.
Sashimi, you don't eat that.
God, man, that's
me
insane.
Neither.
So this is, most people know this, but some of you may not. It's slices of fish, raw fish, sitting on rice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's one thing to have it wrapped up with little teeny pieces, but you got like maybe a quarter pound of raw fish.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That you eat. Now, if you could put it on the Barbie.
Maybe then, right?
Yeah, like you think, here it is. Well, gee, could you cook it first? Anyway, the sushi that we eat is always like California rolls or...
The vegetable thing.
Yeah.
I can't even do that because of the seaweed, Peter.
Oh, I love seaweed.
Maybe someday. I've come around with a lot of other foods, maybe this one.
I was down one time off the coast of Maine with a Chinese man who was... he was of Chinese origin, ABC, American-born Chinese. And he took me to this tide pool. And he was showing me which ones you could eat and which ones you couldn't eat, right?
No kidding.
So I was picking them right out of
the
sea and eating them. So he said, oh, try that one. So I put this one in my mouth, and I went, oh, my God, he said, oh, that one no good.
Oh, yuck.
Hello. Speaking of no good, over the holidays thanks to Julie in Ann Arbor for sending this one. Over the holidays, the state's most polluting animal factory began dumping raw sewage in Lenawee County to avoid a catastrophic overflow of their waste lagoons. The facility, this is like a hog farm, the facility dumped and sprayed raw sewage for over a week onto frozen ground. Once the weather warms, virtually all of the waste will flow downstream into Lime Creek, then into Maumee River, and finally into Lake Erie.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Ah.
So enjoy your pork chop.
Well, I think it's important to know about those things, though, because, you know, better to know than not.
Remember when the first time you were on the show, again, about, what was it, a month now?
Or so, yeah.
And I said that one of the things you did was to keep me on...
On track?
On track. Well,
no,
for
I'm
some
not
reason
doing
or
it.
No, you get my ADD raging. All right, we're going to come back, get your calls at 313-298...
Don't blame it on me, Peter.
WRIF. Everyone needs a scapegoat. 313-298-9743. Jalene Jordan, Peter Werby, right back.
Is WRIF.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Oh, hey, I guess that's us. Welcome back. Peter Werby here with you with Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. And since I'm totally ADD and have a memory of about 15 seconds, you want to sum up what we're talking about? We're talking about the Grammys, won by some of our favorite artists, and a lot of anti-war songs, a lot of anti-war statements.
Yeah. No fewer than 12 nominees had anti-war messages during this one Grammys alone.
Yeah.
And you know what else I meant to tell you, Peter, really quick, is that you know how some of these award shows will... I mean, I remember they were telling them right after the beginning of this invasion of Iraq that they couldn't make onstage anti-war comments. Well, onstage comments this last night's show on any subject were allowed, including Iraq, including Bush, and they said that they are not going to do anything but catch any violations of FCC rules, of course. But you know what? I sat there, and there really wasn't a lot. There wasn't enough, and that's for sure. The Dixie Chicks definitely, you know, brought it to light. Joan Baez was there. But other than that, it was kind of wishy-washy. And you know what they did when the Dixie Chicks won once? You know, Reba McEntire, she's an old gun-toting right-winger, and don't get mad at me for talking
Go
about
ahead.
The guns.
Go ahead.
They show her face right after they give the Dixie Chicks their awards, and it's like, why did you have to ruin my moment? Why?
Was she looking pickle-faced?
She sure was.
Good. Good.
I used to half
and
like
also,
her.
Also, we were talking about Reverend Ted Haggard, who was featured in Jesus Camp and also this HBO special. He was the evangelical head of the National Association of Evangelicals that got outed banging a male prostitute and while doing crystal meth. And now he says... He's completely heterosexual after 3 weeks of getting some training. Anything else we mentioned? Religion. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about religion.
All right, let's go to our phones, 313-298-WRIF. Who should we put on first? Here's TJ. TJ is in Shelby Township. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Doing good.
About that Jesus camp. I mean, I'm 17 years old, and religion's like a really big thing with the youth now.
It is.
It's catching on again, Peter. It's hot. The big churches, the rock and roll in the churches.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, you go to, like, my school is, like, one of the most religious schools you'll ever go to. I have people, like, coming to me and telling me all this stuff about their churches. I've heard that it's, like, the biggest movement since, like, what, the 1950s when it was... huge to go to church every Sunday, you know, dressed up and casual.
I'll tell you, TJ, throughout American history, religion and religious movements have been the strongest in periods when either in crisis periods and when people feel that the country has totally lost its direction. So one can imagine that. But on the other hand, suddenly there are books coming out of the woodwork, including bestsellers, which have been out of the woodwork, like Richard Dawkins' book, The God Illusions. It just moved up on the New York Times bestseller list. A prof I know at Wayne State University just got a commission to do a book on atheism. There's a book, the Atheist Quotation Book. Let me see.
There's like five or six that are out there right now.
Yeah, Sam.
A lot of people are going atheist because there's not, like, that much restrictions on anyone anymore. Like, there is, like, crackdowns on a majority of people, but then there's, like, group of people that get away with it and are like, hey, we got rid of it, like, got away with it once, so why not do it again kind of a thing.
Gotcha. Well, if you want, go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerby.com. Over on the left, it says, Why I Am an Atheist, and there's a bunch of links, including one thing is, I love the question, why won't God heal amputees?
What?
Well, I mean, think about this. People pray for to save their kids or to cure themselves.
To walk again.
It's a miracle. They're walking again.
They push them away and they're healed.
Why won't God ever restore a limb? He can do anything.
Point.
Hey, he is omnipotent. Yes, he is all powerful. Thank you, TJ. Let's see. Here is Kevin. Kevin's in Ypsilanti. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, good afternoon or good evening. I'm a really big fan of your show.
Well, thank you.
I guess I had three points that kind of stood out from what you guys were saying in the beginning.
Sure.
I think a lot of the religious revival that you're seeing has a lot to do with the fact that after 9/11, the predominant, you know, viewpoint that was sold to Americans was that, you know, we're now entering this golden age of capitalism where the end of history is coming and, you know, your purpose in life is simply just to make money and consume. Well, after, you know, the 9/11 happened, that narrative just didn't hold water anymore.
Sure.
So in order for some sort of, you know, way of, for people to deal with that, you had this, you know, all of a sudden religious revival, you know, with Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and all these guys saying that this was God's wrath for, you know, embracing gays.
Huh.
I think that's part of it. The other part of it is that, I mean, when I was driving to Chicago, a lot of times I was just playing with the stations, and then you listen to some of these Christian radio stations, and the three main points they always emphasize, besides abortion is wrong, it's murder, and that, you know, we need to limit immigration so that, you know, the Christian way of life doesn't get diluted. Every single station that I, you know, flipped through, it was always saying the same thing, that these Arab hordes or Muslim barbarians, they need to be controlled, and that, you know, we can't, if we don't support the war, then we're going to help them win, and we're going to have another repeat of 9/11. It's just playing on people's ignorance of another culture.
Well, sure, but we have to ask, how successful is all this? This very, very militant minority of right-wing religious movements and people and spokespeople and talk show hosts and what have you, they make so much noise and they have command of the airwaves. But I think a lot of what passes for religious belief in this country is about a mile wide and an inch deep. I mean, we're the laughing stock of the world in Europe, which is almost completely non-religious. I mean, the churches are empty. The only people that go there are the elderly, the majority, 80% of British people just interviewed think that religion causes more problems than it solves. So, you know, you let me give you an example. I was reading this account of New Year's Eve. This obviously right around then, of New Year's Eve on the Strip in Las Vegas. All right. So these two preachers went there, and you know, women are like going topless, and these guys are going there and saying, "Repent, you're all going to hell." And they had these huge crosses, you know, like 8-foot crosses, and this whole crowd of revelers turned on these guys and were screaming and yelling at them, and, you know, some of them were indignant, saying, "How dare you tell me how to live my life, and how dare you judge me, and what have you." And then, so they went away. But so here are all of these partiers, and I'll bet that if you asked every one of them, say, "Do you believe in God?" And they'd go, yeah. "Do you think the Bible is the literal word of God?" And they go, yeah. And "Do you think Jesus is going to return in our lifetime?" And they'd go, yeah. Because I don't even think it plays much of a role. And I think we've talked about before about how people uniformly lie about their religious beliefs, including church attendance. They all say, "Oh, yeah, I go once and twice a week." And then the sociologists went into these small towns and they did these surveys, and there was probably 10 to 15 times more people would have had to attend these churches than actually did. I don't know if I'm making myself clear. How many people go to church, and then they noted church attendance. And it was about 10% of people said that they go all the time.
That's really surprising,
Kevin. Do you think that, well?
No, I'm joking.
Okay. Here's Jamie from Melvindale. Hi, you're on the air with Peter and Jolene.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
All this talk is making me feel really rapture unready right now, but
okay.
I'll get to my point. You remember when you had your Imagine off a while ago?
Sure.
Okay, well, there's a new one you might want to consider playing on the air.
What's that?
Well, the people at, I believe the website is thepartyposse.com, party people, party party, something like that.
No, it's called, I know what it is. It's thepartyparty.com.
Oh!
Thepartyparty.com.
Oh, so you know of it.
And well, they have Bush singing Imagine.
Yeah, this is the best thing ever.
Yeah. So we had, I know, once I just did Perfect Circle. and singing Imagine, which and also John Lennon. And I asked people to say which one they like better and how old they were. Well, you can imagine how it broke down.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the younger audience liked.
Because.
Perfect Circle.
What's his name from Tool? Why can't I even think?
Maynard?
Maynard from Tool. That's one of his other projects. So it was very. His version of Imagine was very dark.
Oh, yeah. Everything's dark.
Yeah. But then I did it another time. And I played the Bush version as well of him singing Imagine.
But, I'm surprised you would do that.
Well, it's a cut-up. I mean, he didn't really sing it.
I know, but if anything that even remotely sounds like him, usually you don't want anything to do with.
Well, also, that you never heard, oh, Dick is a Killer, have you?
Oh, I think I might have heard that one. You know, in fact, I'm sure I have.
Jamie, did you hear that one, Dick is a Killer?
No.
Well, check that one out. In fact, if I had any clue, let me see. Do you know how to bring... I'll bet you Al knows how. We'll see if we can get that and bring that up on the... but we got to be careful because it could... a lot of the words in there, they have Bush saying, you know?
Yeah.
Because if he said, like, a buck and then front, they would take, you know... Buck,
oh,
and
okay.
Then put a, you know...
Yeah.
Yeah, so they could have...
Well, we better be very careful.
Yeah, I'll be very careful. Thank you, Jamie. Appreciate your call. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's see here. Where are we going? Here is Tim in Detroit. Tim, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, Julian, Pete. Yeah, actually, you guys played Dick is a Killer, I think, about a couple of years ago.
That's yeah.
An excellent song, man. Really funny. Real quick, butyric acid actually is the acid that's found in butter, so it's really harmless stuff.
In butter?
That's all it is, yeah.
Now, we should tell people, that's
yes.
What the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society threw on the decks of these Japanese illegal whalers to stop them from whaling. So what did it do? Did it make it real greasy or real stinky?
Yeah, it makes it kind of, well, first it's very, you know, slippery because of its liquid nature, but then it, you know, gets sticky, so it's hard for them to operate their equipment.
Yeah.
In fact, I think a couple of those guys, I think actually ended up falling overboard their ship. So then the Japanese and the Sea Shepherd people looked for them. This was a few days ago, and they found them.
Right.
And then after that, they kind of went back to, you know, kind of going at each other. I mean, the Japanese wanted to kill the whales, and the Sea Shepherd people wanted to stop that. But at least the Japanese were good enough to save help save the Sea Shepherd people who went overboard.
Well, yeah, that was very dicey for a while. This is down in the Antarctic.
And, yeah.
What is that, the Antarctic Sea? Am I forgetting? Is that the name of it?
I think it's called the Ross Sea, I think.
The Ross, R-O-S-S.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, another thing, and this is, because I had heard that Fresh Air show you were talking about.
Yeah.
Actually, I heard it several times because I often repeat it. Actually, it wasn't Oral Roberts. It was a friend of his.
No. It was a protege of his. In fact, it was a young African-American.
Yeah, and what happened is he read the Bible, and he basically read it in the, you know, the agape sense of the word, the love sense of the word.
Yeah.
And the way he read it, he said, well, everybody's going to heaven. Well, anyway, that's all neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. I wanted to bring up this whacked-out governor in Texas who actually did a pretty good thing for some dubious reasons. There's this virus. It's called HPV.
Right.
And what happens is there's a high likelihood if people get it, especially women, they can get cervical cancer.
Sure.
Now, this guy, he approved this vaccine, which has been proved to actually work and destroy the virus. Now, he does have money in the company that makes this vaccine.
Yeah, a little...
Anyway, I didn't know that
but,
part.
But, you know, some people objected to, I mean, how dare the government insist on vaccine, but, hey...
Well, that's what he hasn't gotten to yet. What this governor is doing is insisting that young... Women.
No, it's not insisting. It's requiring.
Requiring by law that they get this shot. Now, yeah. I don't think that's right.
Well,
I'm actually for it because, I mean, you know, why would we want young women if they would have sex and they get this virus?
But it has to be their choice what goes into their body. It has to be.
But wait a minute. What about other vaccines? Isn't it the law that you have to have these other vaccines?
Some of them, I think.
Well, you know what the right wing does, but it uses that choice argument, and I think you're going to see a lot more harm, you know, caused, you know, to young women and girls later on if this vaccine isn't used. So, I mean, I understand the choice argument, but it's also sort of a neat way to kind of sweep under the rug a lot of the, you know, the potential for harm.
Yeah. All right. Let's see what other people think. Tim, thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Now, I'm at the party site, and it used to be so simple, and now I can't find anything that I'm looking for. here whatsoever. All that, I thought Dick is a Killer and all that would have been on there. Unless now, this must be the same
thing. I do remember that song now, Peter. It's been out for a few years, but it still works.
Yeah, yeah. I'll bring it. I'll bring it for next week or something like that.
Okay.
Okay, let's go back to our phones here, and we will talk with, here's Keith. Keith is in Clinton Township. Keith, hi, it's Peter and Jalene, you're on the air.
Hey, guys, what's going on tonight?
Good.
You know, with the whole religion thing, I mean, it's kind of funny. Religion to me is an amazing thing, but the thing you guys are talking about with Christianity, the funniest thing to me is this. You know, the Bible and all these things say that, you know, love thy neighbor and love everybody except gays and Muslims. It basically, if you're not like a Christian or if you don't believe what we believe, forget you and just, you're not right, you're wrong.
Well, throughout history, of course, you'd have priests on each side of the battle blessing their troops. I mean, classic rock song is Sky Pilot by Eric Burdon. And the Animals, the you know that one, Jalene?
I know the Animals.
Well, no, this is an incredible one thing. It's a great tune. First, I mean, to have any music, it's got to be musically good. But Eric Burdon, I saw him last summer down at Taste Fest in Detroit, and he sang this, and he yelled, right in the middle of this song, he yells, end the effing war.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
good for him.
Religions do not have a good record of tolerance, that's for sure. And we shouldn't heap it just on Christianity, because all you have to do is look at how intolerant Muslims are, Hindus are.
How about the Unitarians? Very tolerant.
Unitarians. Now, there are actually there's Unitarian extremists. They go around and they burn question marks on people's lawns.
What?
That's a joke.
Oh, Peter.
You know, because they don't know that God exists.
Oh, or, Peter Werber.
The other thing, my favorite thing.
Cruel.
They say about Unitarian, the Baptists or the Evangelicals say about the Unitarians. They say the last time they mentioned Jesus Christ in a Unitarian church is when the janitor fell down the basement stairs. All right, thanks a lot. Well, how about, what's his, I can't think of his name, Bill Cosby. He said, I thought my name was Jesus Christ for the first 6 years of my life. He said, every time I'd walk in the room, my dad would say, Jesus Christ,
right.
What have you done?
I remember that one. You're full of them tonight, Peter.
I am. I'm having a
Your
good time.
Your religious jokes.
Yeah. Right.
You got me good there.
Let's go to our old pal, Maurice. Maurice is in Detroit. Hi, Maurice. How you doing?
Hey, Peter. Hi, Julian. How you doing?
Maurice. We're doing great.
Hey.
You know what? I was listening to the news today. They were saying about the United States foreign policy is making other countries want to get nuclear arms.
Uh-huh.
I just was wondering, but that part of their plan to have their policies, they can wage war or other countries will sell arms to them. You ever heard this song by Neil Scott Harrell? It's in the CD called Spirits of Military, the Military, the Military, the Military.
Gil Scott Heron. Yeah.
Pardon?
Gil Scott Heron?
Yes.
Yeah, no, great singer.
It seems like the only way this country's economy can make any money is wage war.
Do you think?
Yeah,
in fact,
the private sector goes, you know, after they start the war, our boys bomb the crap out of the country. The private sector goes in there with the money that the taxpayers use to invest in the war and make profits off it.
Well, we hear, Maurice, of course, this phrase that we've heard it over and over and over again, so it becomes sort of like a proper noun and not even, people don't think of it in its precise terms, which is a military-industrial complex. But Bush's 2008 budget includes $625 billion for the military, which is about $100 billion more than the military budgets of every country in the world. And it is 10 times that of China, for instance. And when Bush took over, it was $295 billion, and it's been 112% increase. So when we talk about creating a national health program or restoring the infrastructure of this country, the wealthiest country in the world, and you think, why are there so many poor people? Why does this country have so many features that that aren't consistent with being the wealthiest country in the world? It's because it's going down this rat hole of military spending and all of it. I mean, you can't have in fact, we'll talk about the budget maybe after our break. You can't have a $625 billion military budget, which is absolutely unnecessary, and still and have any social programs that make the country what it could be. All right, Maurice, thank you very much. We are going to be right back. We'll take your calls. I'm Peter Werby. With me is Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, and our email, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. We'll take your calls. Also want to talk about more about Bush's budget and how it's going to screw the state of Michigan.
This is WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our second hour. Joining me in the studio, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Well, hello.
Well, you are, well, I mean, I'm happy too, but you're ecstatic. Being a singer-songwriter yourself, and I noted that we failed. I should do this every single week. Is your website up and running?
It's up, yeah. It needs to be updated. I go off of my MySpace and my website, but JaleneJordan.com or MySpace.com. / Jalene Jordan Music. If you go to WRIF.com and go to the lineup.
Yeah, do that because you're all
of that's in
spelling
there.
Her name wrong. Just like I have to spell my name wrong for my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E. It's like Juline, J-U-L-I-N-E,
yeah.
Jordan.
Yeah, exactly. But go to the Riff website. That's where you can find Peter. That's where you can find me. That's where you can find podcasts of this show as well.
Oh, that's right. And we're going to probably be on HD radio as well.
Rock on.
Rock on. Yeah, all right, the Dixie Click. Dixie Chicks completed a defiant comeback on Sunday night, winning 5 Grammy Awards after being shunned by the country music establishment over the group's anti-Bush comments leading up to the Iraq War. The Texas Trio won the Best Record and Best Song of the Year for No Regrets Anthem, Not Ready to Make Nice. I wish we had it here. They also won Best Country Album.
I have it in my car.
Which was especially ironic that they won the Best Country Album because they said they no longer consider themselves
country artists. They've leaned toward rock.
Yeah. So
We're not going to probably play them on the riff.
No. You go, girls. Yeah. Can you borrow it? I've never even heard.
Oh, Peter, it's fabulous.
Too. Something else was going through
Big
my
mind. Big Night.
Big Night. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You are going to. We can probably talk about this some other time, but you're going to join the March on the Pentagon on Saturday, March 17th?
I am. You know, you want to know how insane I am? This is how insane I am. Okay. Well, you actually know, but
yes.
This is how insane I am. I'm going to do an overnight air shift here at WRIF, which is awesome. Yeah, midnight to 6 a.m. Oh. 8 o'clock, I get on a plane to D.C. after being that morning. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, literally getting off the air and cruising to the airport, getting on a plane, protesting that afternoon all day, and then I'll be back by 9 o'clock the next morning and back in time to take a nap and then come on the air with you, Peter.
Demanding U.S. out of Iraq now from Iraq to New Orleans, fund people's needs, not the war machine. We were talking before the break. In the new budget, Bush is doubling the Pentagon budget from, and this is his whole strategy. To take our money, and rather than returning it to us as they should in goods and services, because that's the way governments work and they carry out projects that make our life better, instead, Bush is going to make our life and people's life around the world worse. Here's what he's doing for Michigan. Here's what he's doing to Michigan. Medicaid budget is going to be reduced by 1%, but that doesn't even take into account like inflation and the rising cost of medical care all the time. So it's Medicaid. So again, who's going to get hurt? The poorest, the women and children. You know, you always think, those men and everything else is welfare cheats. Well, it's women and children mainly. The home heating aid, 25% reduction. These are people that can't afford their heating bills, so they're living without heat. I don't know about you, Julian, but we're expecting our heating bill is going to be about $400.
Yeah, it's high, definitely.
Yeah, it's very high.
You know, is he trying to counteract this health insurance that he's supposedly giving out?
Let's not even go. That is so
4% or
such
whatever.
A scam. It's not even.
It really is.
But here's what has to happen: the city of Detroit and this group called Heat and Warmth Fund (THAW) have sponsored this third annual Heat the Streets Run. I think this was yesterday to raise money for low income families who need help paying their winter utility bills. This should be available free to everyone. I mean, if we've got $682 billion to waste on the military that we absolutely don't need, that's $100 billion more than every penny spent by every single other country in the world. And in the meantime, thousands and thousands of our citizens are having their water cut off, their heat cut off, to the point where it depends on good-hearted people like us. So first off, we give all our damn tax money to the government, which then spends it on their war industries, and that we have to have these fundraisers in order to get people from not freezing to death. All right, they have community block grants that help poor neighborhoods, down by almost 30%. Special education grants, down 1%. Yeah, screw special education, right? Social services, down almost a third. And the name of this, or the story in the Detroit News is, Bush budget to cut aid to Michigan. It would be one of 4 states to get a cut in funding for Medicaid, the joint state-federal health program for the poor. And an article from the News Journal in Florida, armed to the teeth, America marches towards a military state. Gotta love it, right? If you're already rich.
Well, you know, in the New York Times, they noted that the cost of this war would have paid for universal health care in the U.S., nursery education for all 3- and 4-year-olds in the country, immunization for children around the world against a host of diseases, and still leave about half of the money left over. You know what else, Peter, I thought was pretty
funny? Or you can have a big war machine.
Or you could have that, yeah. The Vietnam War cost about $614 billion at today's prices. And according to the Congressional Research Service, I'm not sure what that is, the Iraq War has so far cost $500 billion.
Yeah, well, it's almost up to $600 billion.
Mm-hmm.
And they estimate that when all the costs are figured in, even if it was to stop today, it's going to cost the American people $2.1 trillion. So we pay out...
For the war?
For the war.
And do you know that in the run-up to this, the Pentagon projected $50 billion?
Yeah, and the people that said it was going to be more, they got blown out. And also the Pentagon, what was that deal where they said that... Well, now they're admitting that, oh, yeah, report says the Pentagon manipulated the intelligence about the war. So it's all a big lie. It's all a big ripoff. And we've got to do more than just be pissed off. I mean, that's important. Here's John calling from Connecticut. John, hi. It's Peter and Jolene here on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi. You were talking about religion, and I was looking at your website and how, you know, the world... It needs a revolution, and I completely agree with that.
Do I say that? I mean, I believe it, but I don't know I said that anywhere. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, what I think the direction that humanity needs to go in as, you know, globally is really an evolution in our state of consciousness.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, this is spiritual... Kind of, and you know, there's, you know, modern day prophets like Eckhart Tolle. I don't know if you've heard of him.
I've heard of him.
Yeah.
We could be our own prophets. So, Bob Dylan, 40 years ago, sang that song, "Don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters." That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
be your own Buddha.
I can tell you don't like Bush. I mean, and you know, I'm not a big fan of him either.
Yeah.
But, wait, don't like him? That's putting it mildly.
Yeah. You're a Bush hater.
Wait a minute. I'm a professional Bush hater.
Right.
Yeah, me too.
I get paid.
Yeah.
We get paid.
Yeah.
Right.
Most of you are amateur Bush haters.
Interesting, though. I mean, this getting a new leader is not going to solve our issues. The thing is, need to spend money on military because of terrorism. I mean, that's a fact of life.
Well, I wouldn't say we need military. I mean, there has to be, until we resolve things, if it can ever be resolved, which I'm often very, very cynical about our ability to, we mostly need police work of the type that we've seen in other countries and what Bushko brags about here. So if they've stopped terrorist acts from occurring in this country since 9/11, since they totally dropped the ball and are completely responsible for 9/11, good for them. I mean, was a little bit of a high price to pay to figure out that we needed some security in this country. I mean, Bush and Condoleezza Rice and the rest of them were being told by, Richard Clark, that there had to be some attention paid to the intentions of Al-Qaeda, and they were completely and absolutely ignored by the CIA, by the FBI, and by Bush, even though they knew something was coming. I don't think they knew anything of this magnitude. I'm sorry. That makes me part of the 9/11 conspiracy, doesn't it? But John, thank you for your opinions. Actually, Jolene, you said you're going to Washington for this march on the Pentagon. I think we talked about this. We did last week about that the Pentagon, as part of the $682 billion budget, they're creating this new ray gun, not like Ronald Reagan, but an actual ray gun. The active denial system that they shoot a beam that makes people feel as though they're about to catch fire.
Where do they get these names? The active denial system.
Well, they have people that that sit around
and
think
make
this up.
Names, right?
Remember, you know, here we go, David Rovick song, Operation Iraqi Liberation.
Yeah,
O-I-L. And then the president of Maliki of Iraq, he had this other one, Operation... You know, same thing. Imposing Law. Operation Imposing Law. O-I-L. I'm saying, are they serious? But, all right, another concert. But let's get some people on the air. Here is Ron. Ron's in Sterling Heights. Ron, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hey, Ron. Ron.
Turn your radio down.
Ron. Okay, we're putting you on hold, dude. Let's see. Where are we here?
He's off feeding the cats.
Oh, my God. Al is probably feeding the cats. Al, are you with us out in Inkster there?
Playing with a dog. I don't have a cat.
Okay.
Hey, we don't care about your sex life.
Peter Ward.
That was neat.
That's terrible.
Speaking of sex life, you know, it was the great American philosopher Patti Smith said, you know, Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine.
That's right. Well, now it turns out, according to this preacher, that whether you want him to or not, he did. So that
takes care of it. Yeah, but I'm kind of curious about Ted Haggerty.
Ted Haggard, the disgraced evangelical minister, the head of the National Association of Evangelicals, who now says he's completely heterosexual after getting banged for 3 years by a gay prostitute while doing crystal meth.
Pretty much. Sums her up.
Now, I got to tell you, Al, before Jolene and I were told years ago by a consultant that we had to keep resetting the discussion.
That's right.
So you would
they
think
spent all that money to get us to do this.
Yeah, so you would think, but actually what I'm doing is I actually love to say that over and over again.
I had a feeling.
Go ahead, Al.
I'm just kind of curious. You know, he spent 3 weeks in a motel room with another man getting deprogrammed and came out completely heterosexual.
No. It was his wife.
No, it was another man. It was another reverend that came out and said, you know, he's completely
really?
Cured him.
Well, that's what the old late comedian Lenny Bruce used to talk about, these anti-homosexual laws. He said, yeah, let me see. Guys break the law against homosexual acts, and then they send them to prison.
Oh, my.
What? Or you end up part of a penal institute.
All right. Let's not go there.
Oh,
all right.
My.
Okay. Al, thanks for joining us. And, I forgot what song that is. Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. It's a great Patti Smith song.
Saw her down at St. Andrews. She was amazing. It was a few years ago.
Her great power to the people.
Power to the people.
People have the power.
People have the power. Yeah.
If we start getting some music in here, we should make that our theme.
I think we should get some music. We should take a poll.
When did
music
I?
Music or no music? I think music.
Yeah. I interviewed her when? 1999. I went to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Awards. And,
how was that?
Oh, that was fabulous.
How was it to interview Patti Smith?
She was depressive.
Was she with you?
Yeah. We were just sitting around. They would make, like, Bonnie Raitt and who else did we? Well,
they all came through, like, cattle calls?
Yeah. No, we actually sat around these tables. It was a very elegant affair.
Did she smoke cigarettes around you?
No.
Okay.
At the Waldorf Astoria.
Ooh.
Yeah. And
fancy.
Then they put us up in these $400... I never got treatment like that before.
Like suites?
Across the street at the W. That was I never thought about that. That was the name.
Oh, my.
I wonder if they still have that name.
They have great beds at those hotels.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
We digress again.
Yeah, we do. Let's see. All right. Let's try Ron again. Ron, are you there? Ron.
Hello.
Ron.
Hi.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Hey, that's great. I was listening to your program. I just turned it on, and I heard you mention something about pagans, you know?
Yeah.
Involved with the religious type of thing.
Right.
And
that's our heritage as Europeans.
Right. And I just like to say that, you know, religion isn't what the object of the lesson to be learned is. It's faith. And, you know, the human race has been brainwashed for the past 2,007 years. And only for us to be under their control religious-wise. That's why the Puritans came over here in the first place.
To?
Yeah, you know, so they could control the masses with their beliefs.
Yeah, well, they were catching a little hell in over there, so rather than sort of being nice to the people that they found here, they just killed them all and stole the land.
Right. See, now
you're what? You're a pagan?
I'm a cleric in the Astaru faith. It's the old Norse religion.
Wow.
And, you know, we're polytheists. We believe, you know, in the goddess and the gods.
I could go for that.
I could go for that, too.
See, this is what people need now is rather than trying to believe in one thing, and which has nothing to do with nature at all. See, we are of the earth.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Know? And we use the power. You know how you were saying earlier about, well, God can grow a limb back. Why doesn't he make that guy's arm grow?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in our faith, when we worship, we offer sacrifice, which I'm not talking about, you know, killing animals or anything like that.
I should hope.
But we offer sacrifice and prayer. And,
right, well, what's the sacrifice?
And come together as a group.
There's chanting involved, right? Kind
of what's that?
Singing and chanting, right?
Right, yeah. We chant. We call upon the powers of the four corners. You know, north, south, east, and west.
I want to hear about the sacrifice. So what's sacrifice?
It's like a sacrifice can be something precious to you. Usually what we do are we bake loaves of bread ourselves in the oven.
Uh-huh.
And then offer the bread and sacrifice. Sometimes we use our own blood, but that's only if we need our own healing and things like that.
Yeah. Wow, blood's involved.
Yeah, but that's the essence of humankind.
Yeah, well, again, I'm, this could get me in some trouble, but when religions get expansive, that's when they cause problems. And the Christianity and Judaism and Islam are Middle Eastern religions. So and I know everyone listening is not from, you know, not a Euro-American, but most of us in this country are. And those origins are pagan. I mean, those, all of us were tribal people at one time.
Right.
Right.
I'm descended from the Germanic tribes.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mom, she hid behind the veil of Catholicism all her whole life, even though she was a witch.
She never recovered.
You know,
recovering Catholic, we call that?
Yeah, and she didn't tell me about it. I had to find out on my own. She wanted me to discover my own faith,
uh-huh.
Not religion. You know what I'm saying?
I got you.
Religion is something you follow blindly. Faith is something you practice.
Well, let's leave that as a definition. Ron, thanks for joining us and bringing up that aspect of stuff. Appreciate it.
You ever been to a pagan ritual?
I have.
Peter, I have too. I've been to a pagan wedding. I've been to all kinds of pagan, sweat lodge.
Yeah.
Did that.
Yeah.
Good times.
I actually, when I was in Tennessee, there's these large communes. I was down there visiting. And they did a May Day, very important. This is the big one. Is that Beltane, I think?
Yes.
Yes. Where this, you know, Universal, again, they are a renewal and, seed planting.
Sounds wonderful,
yeah,
doesn't it?
It does. It does. And you don't got to be afraid of going to hell.
Yeah. You don't have to be preached at.
Right. And I wonder what people think about that, that we are, the religions that dominate in the West are not from our region. They're, and our origins are, like I said, like pagan, and we were all tribal people. But when you think about it, what European, anyone of European extraction knows about their roots 2,000, 3,000 years ago? If people know all about the Middle Eastern religions, right? They know about the origins of the Old Testament and Judaism. They know about Christianity. They know about Islam. How come we don't know?
Here in this country, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How come, and in Europe, how come we don't know about our pagan origins?
Maybe it's just been so, it's just not the popular culture thing. It's been so shoved back, and
well, think about,
and there are those crazy pagans running around, you know?
Well, think about who else the big word for that, I don't even know why I'm using it. People that don't finish college, they always use big words. You know, okay.
It's called, yeah, your excuse.
Deracinated. Deracinated. You're ripped from your roots. And, of course, the people of African origin who were taken by force from Africa, all of their roots are gone too. So they don't know what religions or what spirituality they were connected to in Africa. And also so much of the Hispanic people. Think about the different native religions and the big ones that we don't want to even get into, like the Mayans and the Aztecs and all that. That was kind of ugly. But the smaller convivial nature religions that dominated all the continents, those have been wiped out of our memory. And instead, all we have are these big patriarchal sky god religions that are hierarchical, that don't start.
We could be just hugging trees, all of us. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes, it would. Let's get Dan in Windsor. Dan, thanks for making our show international. You're on the air with Peter and Jolene.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good.
Good. I actually had 2 points to bring up. First of all, I guess you consider me bipartisan in this issue as a Canadian, but when I listen to radio talk shows in the States, I listen to both, the left and the right, and I just feel like you guys are... I just feel like you guys wouldn't exist without each other. Like the right wing talk shows really wouldn't exist without homosexuals or abortions, and I guess left wing talk shows really wouldn't exist without religion.
Well, I don't think that. Listen, there's not very many talk shows that criticize religion. That's always thought of to be the death knell. But for one thing, about 90% of talk shows in the United States are right-wing. So if you're listening to liberal or left-wing shows, you got to search. It's pretty unusual.
Okay. I guess I'll just...
So it's not balanced like that. In fact, if it was balanced, that it would drive conservatives, neocons, Bush Co., right-wingers, all those people out of existence. Their existence depends on there not being opposition. I see.
Okay. All right. And my second point is just about religion. And you said about the amputees, about how, if somebody has an amputee and you pray for them and they don't get healed. I guess my rebuttal for that would be, that is operating under our assumption that, having a leg is best for them, right? Well, we want them to have a leg because that's what would make their life regular and good for us. But then according to God, that wouldn't be best. And having a leg is really nothing, when it comes to your soul. So it's just...
That's a very Buddhist way of thinking of things there.
Yeah, but...
And I mean that in a good way.
I want to see it. I mean, that would change my mind. Heal an amputee, I'm there.
This is a new one, Peter.
Right. Thanks, Dan. What do you think? You think it's going to happen?
A new one. No, I don't think it's going to happen. This is just a new Peter Werbeism.
Okay.
Show me. Oh, God.
Show me the leg.
Love it.
So why won't God heal amputees? They save all sorts of people. A plane goes down, right? And everyone's annihilated on it. And like a little baby survives. It's a miracle. I mean, God intervened. I mean, he lets, 290 people go to this horrible death, but he saves one little kid. What's up with that?
That's a good point.
We should play...
All the questions, Peter.
You actually haven't been here either when... I played with George Carlin's Ten Commandments.
Oh, no, I haven't.
You know why they call them the Ten Commandments? It's a marketing device. like 10 best dressed, 10 most wanted, and he gets it down to 3.
I love that guy.
Yeah. Here's Alan in Jeddo. Is that the name of the town?
Yes.
Jeddo?
Yep.
Where is it near?
It's north of Port Huron.
All right, good. Never
That's
heard
a
of
new
it.
One on me,
yeah.
too.
Go ahead, Alan. You're on the air.
What I wanted to address is there's a caller a while back. He made a very good point, but then he
Can you
made
turn,
a comment.
Hey, Alan, turn your radio 100% off, okay?
And then he made a comment towards the end of his conversation about the contradictions in religion.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to bring to his attention was, although... it does speak against homosexuality in the Bible. It doesn't say anything about hating the homosexual, because the whole basis for the Bible is if you were to love everyone exactly the way you love yourself, exactly as much as you love yourself, then all those sins and everything would never even happen in the first place.
Well, Alan, you are reading a different Bible than I am, because particularly the Old Testament is just filled with God's vengeance and his instructions to wipe out whole people and all these rules, like in Leviticus and Genesis, about if you do this, beat your daughter and kill your wife. And it's got some unpleasant aspects to it. But that people that I know, the Christians that I know, take from particularly the New Testament the idea of Jesus' love, the love of Jesus' love, and how that should be expanded to be all-inclusive. So, good for them. But it's been used too much throughout history to do everything to rationalize war and slavery, the oppression of women, the murder. Fact of hundreds of thousands of women as witches. That's how, by the way, I use that big word about deracinate, about ripping from the roots. I mean, that's one of the ways that the pagan religion was removed from Europe, was through the mass murder of women, who in many ways were the carriers of paganism. I mean, one of the things that St. Patrick did, Patricius, which was his name in Latin, was that he drove the snakes from Ireland. That's what he's known for. That's why we celebrate St. Patrick's Day and everything. The snakes were the pagans. The snakes were the little people that didn't adhere to Christianity. It was a bloody sword, and that's how it came triumphant, as so many religions do, and as how they're still trying to do it. Okay, thank you. Should I tell you what I really think?
I thought that was great.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, please do. Please lay it out for us. Yeah. You're not clear enough.
Let's go to Justin in Howell. Justin, you wanted to talk about that requirement that people get the HPV virus vaccine in Texas. Yeah.
Correct. Hi there. Actually, I'm back up in Lansing here where I live. So when I called, I was in Howell.
Wow.
glad we could keep you company.
Yes, not a problem. Well, my in-laws live down in Harrison Township, so
okay.
You guys are kind of entertaining on the drive up. But something interesting in our area that I kind of find a little bit scary and to a certain degree forbidding, if you will, into our personal choices is they had a whooping cough scare here in East Lansing.
Oh, yeah.
Which realistically over time, it can be kind of, it can be a bad disease if not caught properly, but they are now attempting to get everyone within the East Lansing School District to be immunized from that and most of your childhood, small illnesses, smallpox, et cetera. And if you do not, you will be denied schooling. Which,
wow.
To me is a little bit scary because there is actually an opt-out form that you can fill out, basically saying that if you don't want immunizations, you have to state the reason why, and if it's a rational enough reason, they cannot deny schooling for your child.
Well, you can do it on religious basis, but it used to be, I was just reading about that, I was shocked, that parents would expose their kid to mumps and measles and smallpox so that they would have them as childhood diseases, pardon me, and not contract them because they were very prevalent, 50, 60, 70 years ago and back beyond that. And if you caught them as an adult, I mean, you get, adult mumps or chickenpox.
Shingles.
Yeah,
shingles,
yeah. So it's.
I've never been exposed to chickenpox. If my daughter, who's 2.5, happens to get it, I have to stay far, far away from her because it could be deadly for me.
But I didn't quite get. Do you think that it should be a requirement?
It unnerves me a little bit here because to me, it's one of those you're requiring children to be immunized and do what the government says is safe when, we have autism at an all time high.
Right.
And they are showing corollary links between a lot of these immunization shots and autism, things of that nature.
Wow.
We, as parents, my wife and I have decided not to immunize our child right now. We've read up a lot about it, and it's not the basics because, I went to college, and had a lot of medical training, and it's not the actual immunization that I'm against, giving a small dose of the material, to build up the immune system. It is actually the carriers they use, the mercury and all of these other things that will sit there and in your body for, they have half-life of 75 and 100 years,
Yeah.
That can do damage to your body for years and years and years and years. And that's one of the reasons why we didn't do it. But it just kind of scares me that, we have this sort of localized incident and how many other school districts, throughout the state might tend to hop onto this.
I got you. Well, those are always those things where when someone says, kids shouldn't be forced to be immunized, I go, you're right, because it appeals to my anti-authoritarian streak, and then people will say, yes, but. So more opinion on that, please. 313-298-WRIF. Jillian, I've been so bad, I just have
a lot of emails.
We've got tons of emails. How'd you know that?
See it over there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't do you much good. We got to get you a screen here. Let me see. Someone says touche. This one is too long, so I'm going to have to get back to it. And our printer is out, so I can't. But all of your emails to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I or Jolene or both of us will read. Now, did I ever say on the air that thepartyparty.com, you can't find the songs that I was talking about anymore? But let's see. Let me see if someone gives us this information. Oh, here it is. The specific link, MP3. Thank you. I don't know if I can. Can we play that? You know, can you play stuff from the computer on the air?
I'm not sure about that one.
All right. Will Al come in here and tell us? In the meantime, we'll take a break. Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF.
Weekday night at 10 with Meltdown. It's like getting hit in the head by a 2x4 with a nail in it. Mandatory Metallica. Now, it's your triple play of the mighty Metallica with a big unit every weekday night at 10, exclusively from your one and only Metallica station. 101-WRIF. Everything that rocks. Listening WRIF.com.
Me.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome to our final segment, 313-298-WRIF. Joining me, Jalene Jordan.
Yes.
And, yeah, okay.
I'm here.
Show me you're there. I think we're just going to take calls, but I did want to talk, and I will maybe just for a minute, about Bush. Looks like he's preparing this assault in Iran.
Yeah, there was actually, you sent me an article about something, the 10 reasons
12 consequences of attacking Iran. This is antiwar.com. Hey, for you conservatives and neocons, this is actually a right-wing site, but very anti-war. And they've got the 12 consequences. Actually, there's about four or five, but they've kind of stretched them out. But attacking Iran, Iran would blockade the Straits of Hormuz, which means that you couldn't get any oil through there. Plus, they have all these weapons that they might be able to take incredible, many more U.S. casualties than certainly the Iraqi army. The Iraq, when the U.S. invaded in 2003, had no army. It had an army of dust, as I always
pretty
say.
Much.
Yeah. But the Iran is this huge, modern, well-equipped army. And the United States cannot invade Iran, that's for sure. We don't even have enough men and women to...
do what we're doing now,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. They got almost $700 billion to spend, and we don't have enough army to overcome these guerrillas, these insurgents. War quickly gets out of hand is reason two. Reason three, the world's prosperity would be at risk if oil didn't flow quickly again. American citizens and businesses in many nations would be under threat of attack by militant Iranians and other Muslims, and Iran itself has warned. The Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, he has said that Tehran will strike U.S. interests around the world if his country is attacked. And, hello, it's war, and since they'll be bombing targets that would include civilians, I guess they would think if they hit us somewhere, that's fair. Now, think about this. The United States is fighting a war right on their border. Can you imagine if some country decided to liberate Mexico?
Yeah.
Like the Russians. They say, all right, look, the guy that's in there, he stole the election from the guy that really won. He's a tyrant. So the Russian troops are going to invade and occupy Mexico.
Yeah, it just sounds absurd, doesn't
it? But the United States, under people like Bush and the rest of them, too, think that they can go all around the world invading where they want under false pretenses, and there's not going to be any consequences. Well, this will create a lot of consequences. Now, on the face of it, it just seems absolutely mad to think that the United States would invade Iran.
Yeah.
But that's a problem. There's a couple of things. One, they are mad. They're quite mad.
Yeah. And so it goes along with it quite well.
And the second thing is, Bush rules when chaos reigns. So the idea, for instance, that that they would make this military strike against Iran, and then something would happen in this country or to a U.S. asset somewhere in the world, could very well allow Bush to begin ruling what? By executive fiat.
Yeah, you know, like he does everything else, right?
Yeah, right.
You know, what really scares me just is how much this is coming up in the news. All over the place. Everything. You go to the political sites, or you just go to politics on Yahoo, and it's Iran, 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 Iran. That scares the holy you-know-what out of me.
Well, Patrick Buchanan, who I don't have much to say for normally, says, is bombing Iran Bush's call? And he says, where the hell... I mean, he doesn't say where the hell. He says, who gave President Bush the authority to attack Iran? When was it granted? I mean, isn't there a constitution that says only Congress shall declare war? You would think that if there was a reason to attack Iran, of which there's nothing under international law or United Nations charter that would allow the United States to do that, they would have to get the approval of Congress. And to do it as part of the imperial presidency means that we now have Caesar at the helm.
Although, you know what?
Yeah.
I think that Bush would have a harder time now with Iran than he did with Iraq.
I mean, Who knows? They have the weaponry.
Maybe.
They have weaponry. They could start blowing U.S. ships out of the water that are over there now.
Oh, they have a third
battle group.
Big ship is over there now.
Yeah, well, they have battle groups. They don't ever go by themselves.
Right, yeah.
And they
so
have
they've added another one.
So they have all this Chinese missiles, and the Chinese are probably thinking, I wonder if this stuff works.
Hey.
Yeah, let's see. All right, let's go back to our phones and pick up Stan in Garden City. Stan, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Good evening, everybody. How are you tonight?
Doing good.
That's good. Me too. I believe George W. Bush and his minions are planning a nuclear attack on Iran.
Nuclear? Oh, my.
Yeah. You got Russian President Putin, who was just blasphemizing the United States on the nuclear proliferation treaties that their toilet paper. That's what they're pretty much now.
Yeah, that was this weekend that he did that.
Pretty much what, you know, Russia and China are pretty much on hair trigger alert, pointing their missiles at us. Now, consider...
Well, China is, and China doesn't have that much of a capacity, but certainly Russian missiles are, and that's something that Bush could have moved immediately upon coming into office. But instead, he's expanding nuclear weaponry, including weapons in space.
I don't want people to get upset or, you know, anxious, but consider George Bush's record. He stole two president elections, 2004, walked away from both the Kyoto Accord on global warming and the nuclear nonproliferation agreement. It's a tongue twister. Spent the United States into near bankruptcy. Now all China has to do is call in our debt. Invaded Iraq, lying about the reasons. And most chilling of all, Bush is an end-timer, is a born-again Christian fundamentalist, he believes that the world must be destroyed before Christ can return. So,
other than that, he's okay.
Oh, well, my God. I know, so, you could keep going, too.
Well, yeah. based on the evidence, I submit respectfully that the president is either dangerously insane or certifiably needs to be removed by Congress under the powers stipulated in Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution and 25th Amendment. And considering what's at stake, I hope Congress acts immediately. Thank you.
All right.
You know what?
Thank you, sir.
What was his name?
Stan.
Stan, you could have your own talk show. That was pretty good. Pretty good summing up of things.
And here's what Stan is talking about. That's Neil Young. Let's impeach the president for lying. Lines later on. Let's impeach the president for spying. High crimes and misdemeanors is what this man has committed. I am so curious here. Hi, you're on the air. Is this Tat the Rat or Pat the Rat?
Yeah, Pat the Rat.
Pat the Rat.
Yeah, how you doing?
My old pal.
That's me.
They have you up here as Tat the Rat, but I figured there couldn't be Tat. Okay, how you doing, man? I haven't talked to you in years.
Oh, just fine. But you know, religion, anti-religion's my bag.
Sure.
The thing about paganism, why people don't understand their pagan roots or know anything about it, is there was no public school up until about 100, 150 years ago.
Yeah.
All the education was done in private religious schools. All the history for centuries during feudalism was kept in monasteries written by monks. Now, if you look at Edith Hamilton's book on world mythology, the section on Vikings says there's very little known about Viking mythology because the Christian record keepers suppress the information. Although the days of the week are Thursday is Thor's day,
yeah.
Wednesday is Woden's day, but people don't know any of this because
What about Sunday?
Yeah, at UN in the sun, yeah.
Right.
The whole point is all the history was kept in monasteries. Those are the only people that could read or write. Peasants didn't read or write. And the nobility could read or write, but they got their education from the monks. That's why we don't have any of this history. The history is written by people who conquered everybody else.
You're right.
And that's why we don't know any of these roots. They were deliberately distorted and erased.
Well, all right. Thank you, Pat. I can't imagine that you use the internet.
No, I don't.
Okay, but find some other way to get a hold of me.
Okay. I'll give the producer my phone number if you like.
Okay. All right. Let me put you on hold then, and I will give you a call. Al, can you pick up not Tat the Rat, but Pat the Rat?
Right. Tat is his twin.
Yeah. Pat the Rat used to write wonderful articles for the Fifth Estate newspaper magazine. Yeah. All right. Where are we here? Here's Fred in Detroit. Fred, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
Now, basically, I'm calling. This is my first point was about terrorism.
Sure.
And I was going to second your opinion, your motion that we are spending entirely too much money on toys, not enough on manpower, and we really can't be serious about fighting a war on terrorism when we kick out our best, our best.
I can't fill in the word for you. I can't guess it either. Kick out our best.
I guess people that are dedicated, they're intellectual, but they're gay.
Oh.
Right. Now, when you get rid of our best people, the ones who are patriotic, how can you really say that you're serious about fighting the war on terrorism?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the toys by themselves, it was proven in Vietnam that you can't keep trying to fight a push-button, war. You need bodies.
Well, the Florida News Journal says just what you're saying. The squandering of money on defense contractors swindles, they call it, whether it's the superfluous, in other words, the unneeded $66 billion F-22 fighter jet program, or the $9 billion a year missile shield, which one test aside hasn't gotten much past its middle school science project concept since Ronald Reagan fancied it a quarter century ago, and we've spent so far $160 billion on essentially what is illegal under international law, trying to create this missile shield, which is forbidden. But hey, that's all just, out of here. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call, Fred. Thanks for waiting. I forgot I wanted to mention when you knew this, the 2,000 a pound chocolate for, you knew that, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I had it here. We were talking about Eat the Rich, and it's a song by, an old metal song by Crocus, also an Aerosmith tune. And then a number of people reminded me that it was also done, same tune by the same name, by Lemmy and Motorhead.
Oh, Lemmy. Yeah. Oh, I saw him at Clutch Cargos years ago. And that guy, that Motorhead is so loud that it was like coming through my whole body.
He almost ruined my career once. Back in the day when you couldn't say that. Can you say...
Oh,
you say that
I don't think so.
All right, well,
I don't think you can say that.
Yeah, and
let's be safe and not.
Richard writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com about Eat the Rich. Better get them young before they build up Botox.
Oh, the lovely Botox.
Do you remember last week we had?
Wait, you need to finish your thought.
Oh, why? What about
on the chocolate?
Oh, yeah.
Eat the Rich. This is something, it's Valentine's Day on Wednesday. Yeah. We'll set it up really quickly. And you can get the perfect Valentine's gift for your loved one, a box of Noka chocolates. $39 will get you 0.9 ounces of chocolate.
0.09, isn't it?
0.9.
0.9.
Ounces.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, happy Valentine's.
So in the meantime, Laura, who's in the Navy, who called into the show from Monterey, last week, she says, thank you, Peter, for taking my call last Sunday. You're right. I did join the Navy to help pay for my education expenses. Also, another note with my mother. She's been unemployed for about a year now and can't even get a job at Kohl's or Meijer because there aren't jobs to fill. She recently had a medical emergency and had to spend a week in Harper Hospital with no medical insurance. She called me yesterday letting me know she got her bill. This unemployed woman with a daughter in the Navy who last week she told us on the air that she sends her money owes $14,000. And Laura said that's more than her house is worth.
Oh.
Basically, Bush either needs to go or he needs to fix this mess he's made. Laura, he has no intention of fixing the mess. In fact, he wants to make the mess in terms of not serving the people's needs even worse. And the idea that a senior citizen, or I don't know, I mean, she could even be in her 40s, right? If you have a 21-year-old daughter or
she
something.
Could be,
sure. Like that. But someone who's sick, should have, I mean, that heat and water and food.
You mean the basic
medical
needs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that ought to be a right.
Shelter.
A right of citizenry that you shouldn't, if you know, you don't have any money, you don't eat.
I tell you, my friend Frances in Canada, she just dilly-dallies on down to the little health clinic. They take care of her. She signs a little piece of paper, and off she goes.
And I'll tell you, the complaints that people have, and there are some complaints about the Canadian system, is like most things, because it's not funded properly. And I always say to Canadians, you can have your choice. You can have a Canadian army and essentially wind up participating in U.S. imperial schemes, or you can have a health plan. Canadians ought to disband their entire army. What the hell do they need an army for? Like Costa Rica does not have an army, one of the few countries in the world. They have a police force and what have you. But who's going to invade Canada? There's only one country that would invade Canada, and that's the United States.
Yeah.
And the United States, we've talked about this several times on the show, has contingency plans for invasion and occupation of every single country in the world.
Wow.
Liechtenstein or Andorra, they have like a 3x5 card. Something like Canada has an extensive and complex plan for that if it ever became. I'm not saying that the United States is intending to do this or wants to do it or anything like that, but say something happened. It got taken over by communists or something like that, godless communists, that they don't want to have to, hey, what the hell do we do? How do we handle this? It's already there. It's already there.
Didn't know.
So wherever you're listening in the world, because I know many of you are listening on the Internet, there's plans. All right. Let's take some final calls. We'll go through them quickly. Jerry in St. Clair Shores. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just want to make some comments about our military budget.
Sure.
And I don't see how we can spend more than the rest of the world combined and still justify this as defense spending. There's
there
nothing
go.
Defensive about this. This is... Our military has been on the offense for quite some time, and as such, I think we should be morally offended by that.
Well, Jerry, you may or may not know. In fact, I'll put this as a question. Up until 1945, the Secretary of Defense and the Department of Defense was known as?
The Department of War.
The Department of War and the Secretary of War.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then the fiction began that we were not a competing imperial power, but rather these people that reluctantly went to war and forced to do it. Whereas what we essentially saw and learned was that the only way the United States could get out of the depression of the 1930s was by this transfer of wealth from the people that produce it, you and me and the rest of us, and then given to the government, taken by the government, and used for military expenditures. I mean, there's another way to do it. You could have an incredible cradle-to-grave welfare state. I mean, why do people not like that phrase, welfare state? Taking care of our welfare, the welfare of all its citizenry, should be free schools, including college, free utilities, free food. Why not? Why not? Why not do it? And we wouldn't even have to tax most people very much. I mean, there's so much wealth in this country. Man. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Oh, here's a strange person. A woman. Wow. Bridget, you're on the air.
Thanks. It's late. I happen to be a midwife on my way to a home birth and tuned into your show.
Uh-huh.
And,
cool.
Happened to one of the great choices that we still haven't had taken away from us here in Michigan, at least.
I was going to actually ask you that, Bridget. So midwives are legal?
We are. Nobody cares, basically. We're not necessarily legal, but we're not illegal. Nobody said we couldn't, kind of thing.
Right.
At least not home birth midwives. Anyway, I tuned into the portion of your show about the vaccine and caught my attention because not only do people make the choice about not using some vaccines or all because of the carriers in them, but other things are questionable, such as, you know, the efficacy. And one of the things that I'm concerned about with this new HPV vaccine is who has it been tested on, and are we getting enough information to make informed decisions, or do they even really want us to be informed?
Yeah, I'll tell you, Bridget, this vaccine is pretty new, isn't it?
Yeah.
Brand new.
Brand new. Doesn't, yeah.
But what's happening is they're saturating the television airwaves with ads about this thing, with young women saying, you know, you should get this shot. One Less, it's called. I think that is their campaign, One Less Woman. Have you seen those?
I have, and there's little girls jumping on jump ropes and stuff.
Yeah, it really, personally, it kind of disgusts me.
It's not exactly the image I think of when...
12 years old is when they want these girls to have this HPV, which is a sexually transmitted disease.
Why don't they distribute condoms?
Oh, that's blasphemy, Peter.
Well, and, you know, I don't even know if that's so much the issue for me as much as it is, you know, I just think about how important it is for people to be informed. And it just seems like a lot of times when it comes to things like this, we're just kind of expected to walk into it ignorantly without, you know, having, instead of the, whoops, we, you know, 20 years later, whoops, we made a mistake. We don't do it that way. We do it this way now because we found out everybody's uterus was falling out or whatever.
Exactly.
Terrible. All right, got to end the show. Thanks for being our last caller, Bridget. My apologies for those of you that got left on the line. And let's see, we're going to be talking with, we should either be, I can't remember which interview we're going to do first, either Jeff Montgomery, chair of the Triangle Foundation, or Joel Westheimer, Pledging Allegiance, the Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools. I think I'll go with that one.
Okay, I think that would be a good one to start with.
And we have a final message. Actually, our final message is Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan saying thanks for having joined us. But let's leave the final message once again to Neil Young.
Do it.
is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Pleasure to be with you. How many times in your life have you heard the phrase that began, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the, right? You know that. And I suspect that anyone listening who is in the United States, who went to school in the United States, knows that that pledge by memory. Although you're going to be surprised to learn that there's been a little addition to it over the years. The book that we're going to interview the editor of is called Pledging Allegiance, The Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools. And, pardon me, Joel Westheimer is the editor of it. It has a foreword by historian Howard Zinn. And Joel Westheimer is professor and university research chair in democracy and education at the University of Ottawa and co-director of democraticdialogue.com. That's democraticdialogue.com. We may even talk about that website a little later. Joining me from Ottawa is Joel Westheimer. Welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter. Nice to be with you.
So when people are conjuring up all these patriotic pledges and songs, there's always a little bit of a surprise. Tell us about the Pledge of Allegiance and who wrote that.
Well, as we know, the Pledge of Allegiance was developed by Francis Bellamy, but what a lot of people don't know is that the references to God were not originally in the original pledge and were added quite a bit later.
That was in the 50s to distinguish us from the godless communists.
Exactly. But, you know, people like Francis Bellamy and many of our iconic figures who we link to patriotism and the nation's ideals were actually quite critical of some of the common trends going on in America at the time. For example, sort of rampant unbridled capitalism without reference to the health and well-being of people in the nation. And another good example, of course, is Pete Seeger's This Land Is Your Land, which has many verses which aren't often taught that actually reference the health and well-being of individuals in the nation and not just a kind of blind allegiance to the country. And that's some of the kind of things that that we talk about in the book.
Well, as I remember, that Bellamy, Reverend Bellamy, was a Christian socialist.
Exactly. Yeah. So isn't that shocking?
Yes, and Pete Seeger was very close to the Communist Party.
That's right.
And let me see, America the Beautiful, I believe the woman was gay. Am I correct on that, if you know?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm sorry, folks. I'm sorry to bring this all to you. And, although maybe, like me, you think that's just wonderful. Anyways, Joel Westheimer, tell us about the gestation of your book, Pledging Allegiance, the Politics of Patriotism in America's School. There's an extraordinary number of authors here. And was it easy to get them to write? I mean, people just said, "Oh, yeah, I want to write on that."
Well, you know, there's been an incredible, I was actually surprised because I contacted a few people who I knew would want to contribute to a volume like this, and Howard Zinn jumped right in and several other people. But what was amazing is the number of people who've really done some careful and serious thinking about this issue, especially in the days after 9/11, September 11, 2001. And I think what's going on is that a lot of people, academics, but others as well, social critics, musicians, people from all walks of life in America have really started to think long and hard about what it means to be both a loyal and patriotic American. And many people have come to the realization that there's a growing threat to the idea that to be an American and to be patriotic, one can actually be critical of some American policies. And in fact, some would say that doing that is more patriotic than just blindly following leaders. And so in some ways, I had too many people wanting to contribute, and with people with a lot of interesting new looks at ways of seeing patriotism in the United States.
So this is not an attack on patriotism.
It's not an attack on patriotism. In fact, it's almost the opposite. It's an embrace of patriotism, but for a broader set of definitions of patriotism. So, for example, some people in the United States after 9/11 started to believe that a patriot is someone who agrees with everything the president or the Congress or the Senate says we should be doing and does so without question and does so in a kind of we shouldn't air our dirty laundry. So it's okay to talk in your living room about things you disagree with, but never in public. And others really felt that patriotism in the United States is a love of the ideals and the principles for which America stands, and that defending those is what a true American patriot does. And in times of war crisis, the challenge is not to sort of shut up and go along with whatever's happening, but especially in those times, it's a time to think carefully about how we can improve this country and what we can do to make it stronger, and to express those views both through public speech, through voting, through article writing, through discussions. And a lot of people felt that that is what actually means to be a patriotic citizen. And what we're trying to do in the book is not actually even say that one kind of patriotism is better than the other. There are plenty of places, for example, for a kind of symbolic patriotism where people express love of country through symbolic acts or songs, and everyone would agree with the power that is behind those rituals. But that's not the only kind of patriotism, and what the book does is open up the possibilities to a whole bunch of different ways to be a patriotic American citizen.
I know when I interviewed Chris Hedges, the former New York Times reporter, who's written a couple books, one about his war experiences, and that one he... I wish I would have brought this quote, but he said that patriotism in many ways is the stories we tell ourselves, about essentially how wonderful we are and how this is the best country. And I always wonder when people say America is number one, I wonder how, you know, what do they mean, like Canada where you are now? And you're an American citizen, right, just teaching?
I am. I've been living here in Canada for 5 years.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's minus 39 degrees Celsius, which is minus 38 Fahrenheit here today with the wind chill factor.
Wow. Well, it's not too far away in Detroit today. It's pretty chilly. So, and there's also, and why am I, I'm forgetting a lot today, but the famous quote from the Englishman about that patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. So that patriotism, on one hand, is put forth as something that's important for citizenry, and on the other hand, there's a great suspicion of it, that people, quote, wrap themselves in the flag. I mean, that's what the scoundrel quote is all about. How do you sort that out? I mean, I usually think of scoundrels enunciating the highest degree of patriotism. I mean, they would tell you that, at least.
And, you know, both those ideas have strong currents in American democracy, in the history of American democracy. And the idea that patriotism is the last refuge of scoundrels, of course, signifies that, you know, if you're grasping for any argument to defend a particular position, and if you just can't find any logical, rational argument, then the last place you can go is to just say, well, you know, we need to do this because we're American, or we need to do this because we love our country. And, of course, it has in many times in our history been used to beat down other ideas rather than through democratic debate and through reasoned logic, just through the invocation of patriotism and by wrapping oneself in the flag. And that kind of patriotism we do, of course, attack in the book for good reason. But it doesn't mean that expressions of love of country and expressions of patriotism are all necessarily bad. It's just a question of opening up the kinds of definitions for patriotism that are allowable and healthy in a democratic society.
The book is Pledging Allegiance, The Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools. It's edited by my guest, Joel Westheimer, and it's published by Teachers College Press. You can go to tcpress.com and also democraticdialogue.com as well. Now, it's often challenging. You mentioned the necessity of being critical and speaking one's mind during periods of national crisis, yet that's when it's the most difficult. A critic around the time of 9/11 or the Vietnam War, or even the few years following 9/11, and certainly during World War I, to be a critic of government policy meant you had a pretty tough road to go down.
Absolutely. And when I say 9/11, of course, it's not the first time that there's been this resurgence of kind of a patriotic fervor. It tends to happen around war times where there's a feeling that the public needs to kind of close ranks behind the leader and not express terms of dissent. And it's happened before. What's interesting since 9/11 is that there's been a concerted effort in schools, and that's largely what the book is about, right? The subtitle is The Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools. And schools have always been implicated in this, the drive for patriotism, and especially at wartime. But some of the things that have happened in schools since 9/11 have been particularly of concern to a lot of the authors who contribute to this volume.
Well, it struck me. I remember when I was in school, in like junior high and even elementary, more than in high school, it was a little training ground for, I would say, blind patriotism. The walls were lined with art or photographs of presidents. There was always an American flag. You said the Pledge of Allegiance, and it didn't all seem to be have anything to do with school or, quote, America in the larger sense. In other words, there was, rather than seeing a portrait of even Franklin Roosevelt, let alone Herbert Hoover or somebody like that, or Truman or Eisenhower, it would have been nicer to see, like, photographs of mountains. You know, it's not... tell us a little about that. I mean, the politics of patriotism in America's school. To me, they were teaching blind patriotism. Do you think that, or is that just my perception?
I think that they largely were, and if you look at policy documents and general school board descriptions of what goes on, you'd find the same thing. If you actually go into classrooms, and many of the authors in this book did, including myself, you'll see a different story unfolding in the classrooms across America, a much more complicated story, and that is of individual teachers teaching various forms of patriotism in all kinds of ways, and sometimes getting punished for it or suspended or disciplined for it. But there are a lot of teachers and a growing number throughout the country who have decided that for them, patriotism in terms of education means teaching students the ideas and dispositions required to participate in democratic debate, that there's nothing more patriotic one could do for America than teach our young people how to participate in dialogue. And there are a growing number of teachers who have done terrific activities and curricula in their own classrooms that teach children the different positions, different sides of current events or of past events, and try and get them to think about all the different ways that America can be America and still be, you know, the way that you can be patriotic but support different positions. Now, many teachers have been disciplined for that, and the ACLU has actually taken up a number of cases where teachers have been suspended or disciplined, and students as well, for what would normally be freedom of expression rules.
I know during World War I there's at least one famous case of someone being jailed or near lynched because for passing out the Bill of Rights. And I've been looking at the Constitution lately, something I've never really done. I know it's general outline, but to particularly the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, and even a lot of what's in the Constitution is a strikingly radical departure from what had previously gone before in terms of what citizens were expected to do. That is this absolute loyalty to the ruling apparatus, where suddenly here's a foundation document put in writing, which was pretty unusual, or was totally unusual for that time, saying you have the right to go out in public and dissent, and you have the right to say and publish what you want. This is an extraordinarily radical document. So it's strange somehow how its repressive elements in society will put forth the Constitution and the first 10 amendments in a biblical manner, whereas if they opened the Bible and read from it, it would undercut their view of how people should respond to government.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good point. And, you know, we only have to think, it's interesting when you think of the people you might call the blind patriots, or what I call in the book authoritarian patriots, the kind of patriotism that would be consistent with an authoritarian government, where you're not allowed to think a different way, you need to fall in line and support your leader. And what's interesting is those people we tend to associate with maybe a kind of July 4th celebration, right? They might be decked out in red, white, and blue, have red, white, and blue hats, socks, underwear, everything else. And of course, if you stop to think about it, every July, what American citizens celebrate is a profound questioning and challenge to government authority, and in fact, one so challenging that in that case it led to revolution. And that's not what other kinds of patriotists are advocating in our country, but certainly that questioning
deliberative stance is a fundamental part of American history and the American psyche. And that's also why, you know, Peter, when you were talking about the kind of blind patriotism that's inculcated in schools, what's interesting about America is even if that's what we wanted, and I don't think that's what I would want, but even if there are some people out there who would like students to develop an unquestioning, supportive stance to government and everything it does in the name of America, even if we wanted that, it seems really intuitively clear to all of us who went through saying the Pledge of Allegiance and everything that this wouldn't be an effective pedagogical way to go about it, right? Making students, forcing students to recite the pledge, teaching them not to question things or not let them discuss certain issues or not let them wear certain t-shirts isn't going to be effective in having them fall in line into a sort of one world viewpoint. What it is effective in is turning them off of politics and the real means of debate. And that's what I think is really a tragedy in what's going on in a lot of the schools.
Somebody made the point years ago that the radicals of the 1960s had were raised in the 50s where prayer was mandatory and the pledge was mandatory, so it didn't come out the way they wanted. My guest is Joel Westheimer. And Joel, you mentioned earlier the subtitle of your book, Pledging Allegiance, The Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools. Could you flesh that idea out a little and how the authors treat that and what that means within this context?
Yeah, you know, schools, as we've been talking about, have always been this kind of conflict grounds in how we should teach patriotism to students. But since 9/11, five or six years ago, we have grown in the number of activities and the number of curriculum that's kind of contested in the ways that students learn about patriotism. And a lot has gone on since then. So right after 9/11, some 25 states passed laws or repassed laws that required students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance. And at this time, I think some 35 states either require schools to recite, students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance, or schools to set aside time for the Pledge of Allegiance. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. The Pledge of Allegiance is sort of a proxy for the kinds of patriotic activities that go on in schools. But a lot of laws were passed as well, things like Virginia's House Bill 1912, which the House voted 93-4 that students, any student who declines to stand or to say the Pledge of Allegiance, that student's parents should be notified. And that stood on the books until it was actually finally defeated in the state Senate. But many of the laws like that have passed, and there's a growing idea in schools and has been that any students expressing dissent or political differences with the kind of ruling order should be punished or disciplined, and teachers allowing that kind of dissent or encouraging it should be punished or disciplined. I have, in fact, in Detroit, there was a case a couple years ago, a student named Timothy Geese who wore a T-shirt with an upside-down flag on one side and an anti-war quote by Albert Einstein on the other. And he was suspended. And an administrator, when he questioned this and said it was his constitutional right, it was freedom of speech, and that there was nothing, you know, insightful to violence or anything in his T-shirt, an administrator told him that the Constitution doesn't apply to Bay City students. This was in Bay City High School. And another one mocked him, go tell it to the ACLU, which he went ahead and did.
Yeah, that was bad advice on their
exactly.
part.
Exactly.
Right, because he won the case, right?
He won the case, that's right. Yeah. And the ACLU, you know, with the backing of the ACLU, he won that case. And there are most of these cases, when they are taken through the channels, the schools do back down or are forced to back down, and students and teachers do win. What concerns me and many of the authors in the book, of course, is that we're only hearing about the ones that made it that far. And I know certainly a number of cases, and I'm sure there are hundreds more, where students or teachers were disciplined, suspended, fired for helping students think about these ideas from different perspectives. And that is of growing concern to all of us.
Mm-hmm. Joel Westheimer, several times you've mentioned 9/11 as a watershed event. And this isn't purely academic to you. You actually witnessed the second plane hitting the South Tower of the World Trade Center. What sort of impact outside of horror, I mean, more in terms of what we're talking about here, did that have on you? I mean, I've talked to some people that said they never felt a patriotic urge or the sympathy in their life, and suddenly after this, it was quite pronounced. And here you saw this horrific act. What sort of impact did it have on you?
I did. I was living in New York, and I was standing there with my wife and my daughter at the time. My daughter was 3 years old, and we saw the second plane hit and both towers collapse. And, you know, as you say, and as many people have felt, there was a tremendous feeling first of shock and horror, of course, and in the days that followed, of solidarity and togetherness with people in New York and people across the country. But what was interesting is that in New York, what that then translated to was a huge multiplicity of ideas about how the nation should respond, what should be done. Everyone agreed that we needed national mourning immediately. And that took place, of course, and everyone saw that on TV coverage, all the candles and the vigils. But what people in the rest of the nation did not see, and this probably was the seeds of the idea for this book in my mind, was weekly and sometimes daily protests about rushing to action that we might as a nation regret later on. And, of course, here we are in the middle of things that now a majority of citizens regret in the Iraq War. And that those gatherings, those protests and marches and gatherings in Union Square and Times Square, up 6th Avenue, up 5th Avenue and Broadway, some of these happened every Thursday afternoon for months following 9/11. And the nation's media did not cover these, either local or national. And it started to occur to many of us that there was a quashing of all the legitimate voices of expression following this momentous and horrible event about how the nation should respond. And in my mind, that laid the seeds for the need for this kind of book, especially as it related to the ways that students and the nation's students were learning about the unfolding events that were going on around them.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, and I've been remiss as a host to not really get to the contributors to Pledging Allegiance, which you edited, Joel Westheimer. And there's how many? I can't count. 25, maybe?
Something like that. Yep.
Yeah, 25 people have contributed essays to Pledging Allegiance. Is there a single theme, or is it the one that you mentioned? I mean, about how to. Let me just ask. Is there a central theme that comes out of this?
I think the central theme is that is the idea that a multiplicity of ideas is valuable for any democratic society and certainly for America, and that when we talk about patriotism, we need to talk about patriotisms, really, the many ways that one can express love for the country. And the contributors contribute chapters from a variety of perspectives, what those perspectives share in common is a healthy respect for the views of the other contributors and the idea that we can debate these issues in American society and especially in schools.
We have a lot of listeners in Canada, and Joel, you're an American citizen now teaching at the University of Ottawa, and Canadians love their country, and yet they sometimes think their neighbors to the south are a little wacky. At least that's what to put it bluntly, I probably should have thought of a better way to put it, but can you contrast Canadian and American patriotism?
It has been really interesting, Peter, putting this book together from here. I didn't give it much thought. You know, we're on email, we're on phones, and it seemed to hardly matter where I was. But it did make a difference, and we actually have one chapter in the book by Sharon Cook, a professor here in Canada, and she talks about the idea that Canadian patriotism has many of the same problems running throughout its history, but it's a kind of softer, gentler patriotism, not as demanding of uniformity, not as lockstep as what people here view as present in the American patriotism. Canada has many of the same difficulties around issues of patriotism and what students should do in schools about it, but it seems to be of a less virulent kind than some of the things we worry about in the United States.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Our guest has been Joel Westheimer. The book is Pledging Allegiance, the Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools, and Joel Westheimer edited it. A foreword and also an essay by our favorite historian, Howard Zinn. It's published by Teachers College. You can go to tcpress.com. Also, democraticdialogue.com. Joel Westheimer, thanks for being on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you very much for having me, Peter.
This is WRIM.com. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werbe.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. Joining me in our studios today are Jeffrey Montgomery. He's the executive director of the Triangle Foundation, and also Dawn Wolf. She's director of communications for the group. And Triangle is Michigan's leading organization serving the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and allied communities. And Dawn and Jeff, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Peter. Good to be here.
Now, thank you very much.
Now, you guys have a lot going. There's a lot of issues to talk about, and there's a lot of concerns that don't just affect the communities that you primarily represent. And I was thinking particularly of this lobbying day that you have coming up. It's called Safe Schools Lobby Day. Tell us a bit about that, will you, Jeff?
Well, yeah. For the last couple of sessions in the legislature, we've had bills introduced that would address the issue of bullying in our schools across, you know, kids are bullied, obviously, for many, many reasons. And a very significant reason and a very common reason is young people are often bullied because of their known or perceived sexual orientation or their gender identity. And We have been involved for years in trying to get legislation passed that would address the overall problem of bullying, but certainly include very specifically when the motivation happens to be based on, you know, sexual orientation or identity. And so this year, of course, with a much more favorable legislative terrain, we really are confident that we're going to see a lot of progress on this bill this year, and it's very, very exciting. So we've gotten together with many of the coalition partners who are behind this bill to put on this lobby day on March 28th up in, of course, at Lansing at the Capitol. And it's going to be a really, really important day for legislators from all over the state to hear from people all over the state who really care about this issue. And Don might want to just mention a really one of the most exciting and I think effective parts of this effort is this storytelling campaign.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. It's called the Want to Make the Bullies Stop campaign. And what we're trying to do is provide people, youth and adults who have ever been bullied while attending a Michigan school, a chance to tell their stories anonymously. Because obviously if you're a 13 or 14-year-old kid and you're afraid to go to school, you're not going to want to come to Lansing, you're not going to want to be quoted by a reporter, you're not going to want to take a chance that you're going to attract even more anger by being out about your story. So on our website at www.tri.org, we have a link where you can go to an anonymous website, write your story. The only information we're asking from or for from you is your first name, your county of residence. I'm personally going through. I'm editing out any identifying information, and we will be delivering all of those letters to the state capitol in Lansing on March 28th.
Yes. Are you starting to get them? Are people telling stories?
We're getting a bit just from our own email campaign, but this has not hit the media in any big way yet. We just started sending press releases out at about last week, so I am expecting quite the flood.
Jeff Montgomery, you mentioned that this is going to be a lobbying day, and this would probably be towards legislation. What sort of a statute would you be looking at?
Well, it mandates policies in every school district that that directly address the issue of bullying in schools. And again, based on whether it's racial motivation, ethnic origin, sexual orientation, gender identity, size, or whatever it might be. It really puts the legislature on the spot to say, yes, this is a problem, and we recognize what motivates people to do this, and more importantly, why people are victimized by it. And so we hope that we can get this in there so that these school districts really can begin to pay attention to this issue.
So, yeah.
I'm sorry, the issue is, Peter, is that this covers all kids. For any of the usual reasons other kids use as an excuse to bully them. Adults like to say, oh, this is just a rite of passage. This is just a thing that happens. I'm a victim or a survivor of bullying while in schools. I actually dropped out of school in my junior year because I couldn't take it anymore. Now, nobody knew I was bisexual. They just thought I was overweight or loud or any of the usual reasons. This bill is named Matt's Safe Schools Law on behalf of Matt Epling, who was a 14-year-old boy who killed himself after being bullied. So what's happening is we have kids dropping out of schools, we have kids skipping school, we have kids committing suicide. This isn't just an issue that affects the gay, lesbian, bi, and trans community. This is an issue that affects potentially every kid that goes to school. And one thing that I think is very fascinating is, as I've been researching this, I saw a study that showed that 80% of the kids who said that they were being bullied because somebody thought they were gay were actually straight.
Really? Well, that's because isn't that one of the most awful epithets? Someone can be called you homo.
Yeah,
right?
These days that certainly is still smear of choice.
Well, actually, Dawn, you took away exactly what I was going to put forth about maybe some of the perception. I know when I went to school, I went to a tough Detroit school, and damn, there were, I can't begin to tell you how many times I was fearful to go to school from gangs, from guys that just wanted to take my money, and in many ways it was extraordinarily a difficult period, particularly from the time I was about 12 through 15 in middle school when it was the toughest. So, and I was going to exactly say that people would say, well, that's what it's like growing up, you know, And, yeah, but that doesn't seem good, and it would seem that that's something we'd want to change. But, Jeff Montgomery, you're not talking about criminalizing youth offenders, or is this? Is this more policy for the schools?
This is more policy-oriented, and it's not, no, this isn't a criminal bill. This is a policy sort of bill that would also ensure that there are policies in place at the schools to deal with this, deal with it directly. One thing we find is that in schools, if teachers witness racial or ethnic harassment, they immediately jump to it and stop it and try to do what they can to deal with the problem. When they hear anti-gay things, they just kind of like turn around and walk away from it and ignore it because we believe it's because they don't really feel equipped to deal with it. And maybe this kind of legislation will help them become more confident in dealing with this problem overall, but certainly when it involves gay, lesbian, or trans kids. Bisexual kids.
Well, what form would this take, or would it be up to each district to shape policy?
Well, each school district would be required to have a uniform policy. They would each be required to have sensitivity training, teaching their staff and teachers, okay, if bullying behavior happens, this is how you need to deal with it. You need how you need to discipline the children involved, educate them that what they're doing isn't okay. And it requires them to report incidents of bullying so we can actually track more scientifically than we've been able to, just how widespread the problem is, where it is, what school districts need more help.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, if there are people listening and thinking, oh, man, this is another level of bureaucracy or another level of funding or something like that, there are already schools that have this in place. I was talking to a teacher friend of mine who teaches at Cranbrook. And I don't know whether you're aware of what each schools or what schools do have it, but if you call somebody a homo, if you call somebody an N-word, if you call somebody a raghead or something like that, you've got a problem on your hands in terms of dealing with teachers. So there are some schools that already do this as a matter of course and think that it helps the educational process.
Well, and also, I mean, allegedly, schools are supposed to be safe places for kids anyway, and so... supposedly, teachers and administrators are looking out for this sort of thing anyway. This just sort of formalizes it and makes it a much more uniform kind of way to deal with this thing. And it's not a cost thing. It's not a paperwork thing. It's the right thing to be doing to make the world, the school world, safer for these young people.
And there's another thing as well. I sympathize. I have friends who are teachers who have told me, we fill out so much paperwork. But here's the thing. Your listeners can't see this poster I'm looking at, but this is our flyer. And I have the pictures of three young people, Christina Calco, Matt Epling, and Crystal Ann Eaton. All three of these are teenagers who committed suicide rather than face bullying. Now, would you rather fill out more paperwork, or would you rather have more kids kill themselves?
Yeah, fill out the paperwork or attend a funeral. Your choice.
Yeah.
This is the Peter Werbe Show, and with me in the studio, Executive Director of the Triangle Foundation, Jeffrey Montgomery, and also Dawn Wolf, Director of Communications. Triangle is an organization serving the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and allied communities. Tell me about allied communities and how they figure in this anti-bullying campaign, because it's not just gay organizations that are interested in this bill, is it?
No, absolutely not. There's all sorts of organizations that are working on this, and some of them have come about specifically to deal with this issue because, as Don said, this is called Matt's Safe School Law, named for Matt Epling, a young man who was bullied, and there's no specific reason to know exactly why that happened, but certainly that has brought a lot of people to this issue just because it's such a tragic situation in our schools. And so, we have support from actually a growing number of legislators, which is a good thing, but also many organizations are coming together to help pass this with us this time.
A Triangle is actually part of the Michigan Safe Schools Coalition, and just today I received word that the Episcopal Diocese of Michigan is throwing their weight behind Safe Schools Lobby Day.
So is this a done deal? You think this is going to sail through?
Well, our work in Lansing is never based on assumptions, and
okay.
I don't know of anything that I would predict would sail through Lansing right now. However, we have a great deal of support for this bill, more than we ever have in the past, and we have people from both sides of the aisle getting behind this bill now, which is a little bit different than it has been in the past. And we have the aggressive support of the governor's office on this bill, which is helpful. And so so we're very, very confident and optimistic. And you know, it always seems with me that I'm confident and optimistic simply because I know what we're doing is the right thing to be doing. But when you get into a legislative chamber, that doesn't always count for everything.
The best thing that your listeners can do is to log on to our website at www.tri.org and register to come out for Safe Schools Lobby Day. We're asking you to meet with your state representative, your state senator. It's free. We provide the training. We'll even provide your lunch. Go to them, tell them in person that you want Michigan schools to be safe for every student that walks in the door. That will help immensely. If you're a student or you were once bullied or several times bullied while in a public school and you want to help make the bully stop, you can also write a letter. And we'll take it to Lansing for you. You don't have to take any risks to do this. We'll do the work. We just want to be able to get this passed and make the schools safer.
Yeah, and that's, again, TRI.org, and you can go to my website where there's a link as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E, Peter Werbe, .org. George Bush gave his State of the Union, Governor Granholm gave her State of the State, and Jeff Montgomery, we've been talking about the state of our gay citizens in Michigan and Detroit area specifically for, oh, I don't know, quite a few years. So, and I almost... I can't put a number on, but it could probably go back into the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it particularly at that time, it was a community that that was ravaged by AIDS, that was subject to gay bashing, that discrimination is rampant, was rampant. And I guess the question is, what are things like today? There, am I, from the outside looking in, it looks a lot better. How does it look from the inside looking out?
Well, it's still very frustrating. I mean, some of those things you just mentioned are things that are still plaguing us and very daunting for us today. There still is a very unacceptable, well, there is no acceptable level of violence, but there still is a very, very serious problem of violence against our community that remains. Discrimination is still legal in Michigan against gay and lesbian trans people. You know, we haven't in the 15... nearly 16 years that Triangle has been working on it, there is yet to be a bill that recognizes that GLBT people are victims of hate crimes anyway. These crime reports and victims come to us on a daily and weekly basis even now. And so I think that for a lot of people listening, many of us, I think, are aware, and, you know, we see television programming that seems to be kind of pro-gay. We see a lot of very good characterizations of things in movies, the Brokeback Mountain phenomenon, and people kind of get the idea, and, you know, office holders at every level are out of the closet now, and everybody kind of thinks, well, things must be really getting much better. And in a lot of ways, they are, but we still are plagued by violence. We're still plagued by discrimination. As confident as we are that this safe schools law is going to pass, I am not confident at all that we are going to see anytime soon an amendment to the state civil rights law that will make it illegal to discriminate against GLBT people. Today, you can still lose your job, you can lose your house, you can be refused service in a hotel or a restaurant. Just if the person thinks or knows. They think your gender identity is or your sexual orientation. So, you know, on the surface, cosmetically, I think things look a lot better for us, and we're, you know, a lot of good things have happened, but some of those fundamental things have not happened. And it still is, as we mentioned earlier about the bully bill, it still seems acceptable to smear queer people, to say funny and stupid things about them, mean things about them, to act out with violence against us. And so we still have those same challenges, although we're a little bit closer, I think, to a day that we're going to really see some corrective things take place.
Well, I know there's always an analogy between the civil rights struggle for African-American people and that same analogous struggle for gay people. And where...
I guess it's similar in that there's these legal guarantees for African Americans. There's certainly a lot more acceptance. But then I think sometimes what I hear in locker rooms of gyms that I go to, on one hand, racist remarks and then and also homophobic remarks. And I think to myself, what year is this? You know, have these people gone nowhere in their thinking? I think the that at least now that overtly and it, I don't know. I mean, you'll have to tell me how much of a progress you think this is, that people at least know enough to not make public utterances that are intolerant, that they don't feel that they can any longer make those assumptions that they can make bigoted remarks against racial or sexual orientation, and it's okay. They don't think it's okay.
Well, we saw a very interesting thing just in the last couple of weeks with this television star who made the who used faggot in describing a supposedly gay co-star with him on Grey's Anatomy.
He says that in the acting community. I can't. This is never mind. Go ahead.
And you know, I was really, you know, when I first heard all of this, I thought, well, you know, this is, you know, we'll see what happens with the story. And I was really surprised, pleasantly, that attracted the kind of outrage that it did, both from all sectors, really, including his own co-stars and so forth. And so, you know, I think a year ago, I don't think that would have had the result and turned out the way it did, that particular incident. So that is true to an extent, but it's also still very true that someone is in an office situation or in a social group or whatever is much more likely to call somebody on a racial or ethnic epithet than they are if it happens to be an anti-gay remark that they're making.
Yeah, the reason I said that about how odd it was that he said that in the community of actors, not just because there's a good number of gay actors, but also because the community is very tolerant and very liberal, and right. It would seem like the last place in the world that you would say something like that.
Well,
go ahead.
If I may, here's the thing, though, and Jeff said this is part of other things he was saying, and I want to stress this. A lot of people in our state don't know that you can be fired if your boss thinks you're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender. Yes, that is legal. You have no recourse. And as far as making bigoted statements, listen to some of the so-called religious leaders out there, the Gary Glenns, the Jerry Falwells, the Dr. James Dobsons. They slander us and say that we shouldn't be able to raise children. Substitute African-American for same-sex couples in there, and you see how incredibly offensive that is. If somebody said that African-American couples shouldn't be able to raise children, you'd have riots. They say that about same-sex couples, and some people actually just shrug.
And that's the thing, Peter. I think this overall thing about why, you know, why maybe the question would be, why aren't we as far ahead as people think we are or as we should be or whatever, however you want to frame that question. And Don's raised a great point. Part of the reason is that we have these religious nuts out there, these fundamentalist, dangerously fundamentalist people who have a mouthpiece from which to spew their venom toward us, and they get away with this on the guise of expressing their firmly held religious belief, which is fine. But they do so much damage, and they have so much influence that if we could bring them around to a point that they would stop bullying the whole community in general, and that they would have to be somehow made responsible for the effects of the things that they say, I think we'd be a lot better off. But we have our own Taliban in this country, and they happen to wear suits and preach in mega churches, but. That is a huge threat to decency and our community.
And joining me is the executive director of the Triangle Foundation, Jeff Montgomery, and joined by Dawn Wolf, who's the director of communications. You know, we've got about 4.5 more minutes, and the Triangle Foundation does such an incredible amount of events and representation and advocacy and all of that. I'm sure that we can never get to it. TRI.org is a good place to check it all out, including the lobbying day for safe schools. But maybe we can just save like the last minute and a half, which is probably a longer amount of time than you think. But I'm interested in your reaction. Now, first, the state, as far as I'm concerned, thoroughly disgraced itself. The voters did by
putting in its foundation document denying people who love one another the ability to marry. And we were assured, though, the voters were, that voted against gay marriage, this would not affect domestic partnership, and now it has.
Well, yeah, we had a very, very, very bad day last Friday when the Court of Appeals ruled an opinion that Proposition 2, or the anti-marriage amendment, as it is now, indeed will prevent domestic public employers from extending domestic partner benefits to employees. And as you said, Peter, we were assured by the proponents of this bigoted bill that they were only talking about marriage and that they had no interest in dealing with people's benefits and health care. And as soon as that bill passed, the right-wing people came in and demanded this opinion that an unfortunate opinion by the unfortunate Attorney General Mike Cox came out with. It was challenged. And now the latest step in that is that the Appeals Court of Michigan has upheld the domestic partnership benefits are the same as marriage. It is a slap in the face and an insult to not only gay and lesbian couples, but it's also very, very mean-spirited because now entire families are out there without health care.
I was going to say, this yanks health insurance away from children away from
and spouses. Yeah. And so it's just it's a wicked, wicked thing.
In between the lines this week, they talk about one of the families that were, involved in the suit, but one family that's going to lose health insurance. These two gentlemen have adopted several children, three or four children, one or two of whom have special medical needs. And so the state appeals court basically said, you kids don't get to see a doctor because you have the wrong dads. Mm-hmm. Once again, so-called pro-family groups have been proponents of legislation that are hurting real families.
All right, we are almost towards the end of our show, and we'll see how there's other courts and other appeals. The way it looks and the way the courts are stacked, it's not, well, we'll
yeah,
just
Yeah, we can't wait
see.
For the next round of the Michigan Supreme Court, that bastion of enlightenment.
Yes. All right, tell us quickly what is going to be happening in the days to come. As we're broadcasting, there's about 48 days until the Safe Schools Lobby Day, but I know you have a comedy event.
Yes, to help us through these problems. We do laugh and we do bring in comedians for the Michigan Comedy Fest, which we've been producing for several years now. And we've got four great national comedians. Carlise Burke, Nico Santos, Sabrina Matthews, and Karen Ripley will be here. The event's at the Ford Community Performing Arts Center in Dearborn. Again, you can go to the Triangle website that Don has been saying, or you can go to comedyfest.org. That's another place you can find out information. It is on the 10th of March, Saturday the 10th of March. It's a great night. There's two shows, 6 o'clock and 9:30, and it's a lot of fun, and we have a gay old time.
And then there's the big event, Motor City Pride.
That'll be the first weekend in June, and plans are still shaping up for it, but our Pride festivals tend to draw about 50,000 people per year. This is in downtown Ferndale, and we'll just keep praying for sunshine and for it not to be too hot.
Yes, and everyone's invited, just like you don't have to
that
be black.
That is a huge party.
Yeah, you don't have to go be black to take part in an African-American civil rights march.
No, we invite the hugest community possible. It's a great opportunity to become more familiar with the GLBT community. If you aren't already.
Well, I want to thank both of you for being with me on the Peter Werbe Show. Jeff Montgomery, Executive Director of the Triangle Foundation, and Dawn Wolf, Director of Communications. Again, it's TRI.org for more information on all of these events, or there's a link on my site, peterwerbe.com. Jeff, Dawn, thanks for being with me.
Peter, thank you very much. You're the best radio going.
Thank you very much for having us.
This is WRIN.com.